Good evening, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of Riddles in the Dark. This is Professor Corey Olson, Tolkien Professor, joining you here for a special episode. We have the whole crew, plus our good friend and Tolkien Professor, producer Laura Burkholz, joining us this evening. And we're going to have a little roundtable discussion here about the trailer as we go through. Of course, any comments or questions that you guys have, observations, contributions to our discussion are welcome. If you see the section on your GoToWebinar control panel called questions, you type in questions there, and the four of us will be able to see those as you go. So we should be able to include some of your observations as we go along. I am not gonna, you're not going to be having the dubious pleasure of seeing my face the whole time. I'm going to turn off my webcam here in a minute. Just wanted to say hi to everybody. And then we're going to turn on the trailer and you'll just hear the four of us talking about it. So again, we have Dave Kale, Trish Lambert, Laura Burkholz, and me here this evening. You guys want to say hello?
Hello.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Dave is just apologizing in advance for all of the things he's going to say. So, okay. So without further ado, we will get to it. So I'll see you guys later.
Corey, our recording button's still not on.
It will be.
I guess
now.
Maybe now it will be. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Okay. Now it is.
By the way, very briefly, people apparently aren't aware of this. There is a little chat thing on there that I don't know how we can use this or what. I think other people can our listeners can even type into it, or at least they should try, but
yeah, Dave. No, it's not there.
If you haven't expanded it
no,
and looked at it, like I see like 10 people have, 10 people responded yes when I said, are you seeing this? But a bunch of other people didn't, maybe they were just didn't feel like it. But somebody mentioned that they saw it, but they didn't get a signal. There was a message. So there is a chat thing, and we might use it. So you might want to just open it up and sort of take a look and see if we type stuff in there. All right. Oh, and then some people are on iPads and stuff. You probably can't see it. Sorry.
Yeah, that's often true. The iPad and the...
And that's Yana.
Yes.
Yana and, is on his iPad.
Sorry, Yana.
Kudos to Yana, by the way, for getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to join us here this evening. Yana, once again, cementing his most dedicated Riddles in the Dark fan title here this evening.
I think Yana might live up to his name.
Yeah. Okay, so I was thinking we should start off by just sort of watching it through. I mean, we can kind of make some comments as we go along, and then we'll go back and do it segment by segment, all right? So we ready?
Mm-hmm. Right, that sounds good, yep.
Where does your journey end?
It's so pretty, the mountain.
You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule. The quest to reclaim a homeland and slay a dragon.
Was a long, dramatic pause. Wow.
Do
Put on the ring! Put it on! Pressing yourself against the wall, not good enough. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the ring?
That is the big, my big question anyway about the end there. Okay, so. Okay.
Are we sure he's not wearing the ring and they were just showing us what he looked
like? That's what I was wondering.
You know, but they've never done that. They've never once done.
I know.
In the Lord of the Rings or film one, whenever somebody is wearing the ring, they've never shown them in regular picture.
That's true. Right.
It's never happened, and I can't imagine they're going to break that rule.
It'd be hard to film if he had the ring on, I suppose. It wouldn't be as exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Hans asks, what is Will Turner doing in Lake Town? That is exactly what I was thinking. Oh my goodness, he looks so exactly like Will Turner. Wow, yes. See, yeah, Dom was suggesting that too, that he has the ring on but is visible to us. If so, then he's completely breaking all of his internal rules. That is, Jackson is breaking all of his internal rules. All the things that he's led us to expect, because there is absolutely zero precedent for that in four movies. But yeah, it certainly would seem like if there's a time to put on the ring, it would be then. Okay, well, let's go back and sort of start a little bit more systematically. And I want to do the first couple groups, first couple sections frame by frame. And actually, I want to separate the visual images from the Thranduil voiceover we get at the beginning. So ignore the text for now, ignore the voiceover. And I want to first talk about the images here. Not these. We know what those are. This first. Okay. Now, this has to be rowing from Lake Town to the mountain, right?
Yes.
Right.
It's got to be.
There's no other options there.
But at first, it didn't look like the boat was big enough to hold everybody, but I just think it's really far away.
Yeah.
When I looked again, I think you actually can't see everybody.
Trish was tricked by perspective.
Yeah, I do think it probably is. But of course, one thing that this shows, this is the kind of thing that that I think we always have to be careful about. Like, it's so easy to go through these things, and whenever the film does something which is in fact just like the book, people kind of pass it over without any comment and then like put a magnifying glass up to every way in which it's changed. I did not take this for granted, that this was going to happen, that people from Lake Town were going to be rowing them towards the mountain. So it seems that either A, the dwarves have stolen a boat from from Lake Town and are rowing themselves to the Lonely Mountain, or else somebody is giving them some degree of help at Lake Town. And again, that I wasn't assuming. So I think that that's kind of an interesting point.
And without ponies, by the way.
Right,
I don't see any ponies.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, in the book...
I didn't think there would be, actually.
In the book, I think the ponies were led around and met them on the beach. So, like, they were rowed up from the town, but somebody else had set out and met them. Because that's where, when they went back, remember, after they're in the mountain, they send Feely and Kiwi back to the supply dump, which was the place where they met, where the boat met the ponies. So the ponies were never in the boats.
Okay.
But that was sort of logistically managed in the book. I don't get the impression we're going to get ponies here. First of all, there's not that far to go. I mean, they've got nothing but mountain climbing, it looks like, between them and the mountain from where they're going to be landing. It is also much colder than I would have expected.
It is pretty cold.
I mean, we talked about it briefly that when we in our Bard episode, I think, how we're getting snow flurries in Lake Town in that Bard picture. Even when we saw that in a still. I was sort of wondering then. I mean, yes, of course, it's supposed to be getting towards Durin's Day, but I mean, it's supposed to be early still. They seem to be putting this well into winter. I suppose just to pick up on the desolation thing, you know, like they're making it all wintry. You know, maybe they're doing a kind of a seasonal arc. Maybe we're going to get something, you know, it's not going to be spring at the Battle of Five Armies, presumably, but film one was pretty autumnal, and film two looks like it's going to be wintery. You know, so maybe there will be... It seems unlikely that they're going to stretch it out until spring for film three.
Film three will be spring. It's the George R. R. Martin weather.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a well established pattern. That trajectory is followed in the Lord of the Rings plot, of course. You know, we set out from the Shire in the fall and then have winter and then move on to a spring of little hope, as Aragorn says. Which of course turns out fairly well, but anyway, yeah. So I just it's a small detail, but I find it pretty interesting that we're getting cold weather and snow pretty consistently, which to me kind of changes the visual picture.
Isn't this pretty far north? You know, I mean, and it's Durin's Day is the very very last part of autumn. Speaking as someone who lives in Wisconsin, you know, it's very possible to get this kind of weather
at the end of autumn,
which, depending on how they define it, is the middle of towards the end of December. So,
right.
I was thinking that it could be altitude, but when Bilbo climbs the tree in Mirkwood, it's autumn, right? The leaves are color, and when they take the barrels, don't they go down the river? I mean, wouldn't Lake Town then be at a lower altitude than the elves? And then how do they get back up? If this is higher altitude, how do they get back up? So I don't know. I mean, and the time, it's like it can't be that many days since he climbed the tree, really.
Well, it depends on how long the captivity by the elves is. And
I guess that's true.
That's a relatively plastic time frame. I mean, the book isn't really explicit. That is, the Hobbit book isn't explicit. The fact that the arrival at Lake Town, you know, like the feast of welcome at Lake Town, coincides with Bilbo's birthday is a later touch. That was not present in the Hobbit itself. That's a retrospective detail from the Fellowship of the Ring perspective. Trish and Laura, as you'll remember from the in the early drafts, in the first draft of The Hobbit, they were prisoners of the elves for months. I mean, it was like the next year when they got out. So, you know, I mean, there's it's possible. It's precedent. There's precedent for that. Yeah.
Could this be instead of the lake, instead of Long Lake, could this be the river? And so they've gone upstream and higher in elevation.
It's possible. And further north. I mean, they could be doing a more, you know, a, sort of a deliberately, you know, Laura, as you were suggesting, a more kind of, you know, Nordic climate up here, even in Lake Town.
Is Peter Jackson going to worry that much about that kind of detail?
Well, so, maps and distances and times are not things that the films have shown a great deal of sensitivity towards thus far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks really cool. And it just
every time I look at this, I keep thinking of the Matterhorn at Disneyland.
Yeah, me too. It looks like the Matterhorn, sort of.
It's a lovely mountain. I mean, I think visually, I think that this shot is stunning. It really is.
It also looks like the sort of the logo or intro screen for, is it Columbia Pictures?
Paramount? Paramount Pictures. Yeah, Paramount. Greg just said Paramount. Yep.
Yeah, this also looks like the Paramount logo.
Yeah. See, you know, I agree. You know, Kate and Wilfred have both been making comments about Narnia, and that's exactly what I was thinking about. You know, always winter and never Christmas. I think that thematically that probably is. You know, Wilfred, I doubt, in fact, that Father Christmas is going to make an appearance and bring Bilbo a gift after Smaug has been defeated. But I thematically speaking, I do think that it's not surprising when you think about it that they would want to associate, winter with the desolation and the kind of bleakness that they're foregrounding, that obviously choosing to foregrounding through the title of the film.
And Brianna has reminded me that in the podcast that I just got published today, that we actually do see in the live footage that, you know, in the piece that she put together, we do see the people of Lake Town sending the dwarves off in a boat from Lake Town.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, I thought the theft of a boat theory was pretty far-fetched, so that certainly does seem more likely. But it's interesting. It's, you know, and So we'll get to that later when we talk about the Will Turner. Excuse me, I mean the Bard scene later on in the trailer. But that is, I think, an important one. Okay, let's go on visually to the next one.
I can't believe it.
What? Sorry.
I can't believe how many people are bringing up Father Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
We've had like three people at least bring up Father
Christmas.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
I propose that maybe they're sailing on the lake on the Black Pearl.
Johnny Depp will be a surprise cameo appearance.
Yeah, that's right. But did you see Ben's joke about cold meaning the same thing for us? I agree. Yeah. I agree, Ben. Looking at that first shot, it looks like the temperature's probably managed to drop all the way down into the 50s.
That's right. Yeah, it's true.
Maybe a cold to Corey is different jacket. Than cold to Dave. Yeah.
Well, you know, it looks like you can see your breath in some of those in the lake town scenes. So, you know, that counts as cold. You know, it's not like your snot freeze is cold, but it's, you know, it's definitely winter chill.
So what do we got here? Are they doing some embellishment on the exterior of the Lonely Mountain?
Well, you have to think. I mean, this is
there are tiny figures clamoring about the massive hand.
Do you think the secret door is behind that axe head?
Well, we did see a little preview of the, you know, little bay in the side of the mountain where the secret door, you know, when we saw the thrush knocking snails at the end of the first film.
Right.
Doesn't seem like it'd be very secret if this is right outside the secret door.
Right. What I'm guessing here is that this must be a route up into the mountain that Thorin knows. It doesn't seem to me shocking to think that the dwarves who carved these monumental statues in the side of the mountain also made them functional, you know, that they would have included secret stairs and passageways among them and used them as routes up into the mountain. I can easily, you know, that seems perfectly plausible to me. I certainly hope that that's not like the direct highway to the secret door. It's something which is actually an interesting question to me. Basically, how you handle Thorin's character, even in the book, it's a little bit odd when Thorin has never even heard of the secret door. I mean, admittedly, he was pretty young, but like, how old do you have to be before your dad and your grandfather tell you about like the emergency exit to the place? You know, I mean, like. Okay, maybe, you know, you don't tell your toddlers about this and have them running out and causing havoc, though I guess you can only open the door, like, once every couple decades anyway. But point is, the question of why didn't Thorin know about this secret door in the first place? Why did his father and grandfather keep it from him even after the disaster? You know, because it's not until he gets the map that he learns what it was. My suspicion here is that this is going to be a route that Thorin's going to be leading them. And so it's going to show, you know, there's going to be this element of like, I am back on my home terrain. Like, I know all the ways around here. And that's going to be kind of balanced against the whole secret door thing that's going to require the map. But as I say, it's something that I find a kind of a delicate thing to handle with Thorin's character. But certainly thematically, this scene, you know, from a concept standpoint, this scene is really cool with them kind of crawling over the hands and up the axe of the mighty dwarves of old.
You can see a staircase underneath the hand there.
Yeah.
Some of them are actually on the stairs.
There. Yeah, over here, yeah.
Yeah, although how do they get from one angle to the other?
Well,
the stairs might turn around or something.
That's right. Yeah, it's carved in that you can't see.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. You know, it's you have to do like an Escher thing as you're going up the stairs there.
Yeah.
But that's fine. Tony's saying it looks like the stairs do turn left, and I suspect he is correct about that.
But then you wonder why there's people walking on the cuff of the, you know, it's like they go from the stairs that are turning to the left to the guy's cuff. Anyway.
Well, maybe you come up here, and it goes up this way, and you come out over here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I'm thinking it winds out, winds around.
But anyway, this is you know, I think the thematically, the what they have going on with these first three images that they're giving us, we've got, you know, the prominence of the snow covered you know, so frosty and dead, lonely mountain at the beginning, looking beautiful but desolate and abandoned. Then we get the statues, which we saw in their glory back at the beginning of the first film, and now we're seeing them in decay but still proud. And, you know, Thorin and company, you know, ascending up these statues of the ancient dwarves, you know, which definitely has, you know, I am here to recover my kingdom all over it. And then, of course, the third one. And this, of course, would be the ruins of Dale, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah. Now, Cody, the like dome here, that looks familiar.
That looks like the foot of the Lonely Mountain in the, behind, right?
Presumably, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I was just thinking, I wonder if the winter, could that be due to smog somehow?
Well, at least thematic. I mean, it seems ironic because, of course, the dragon like literally omits heat. And mm-hmm. so the actual physical description of the inside of the mountain is like terribly hot and stuffy because of the presence of the dragon, and steam is emerging from its mouth. Now, that is a detail that they do seem to have kept. Because there was a poster, right? Wasn't there a movie poster for this yes. film that was released recently that showed the front gate with steam coming out of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So clearly they're keeping that particular detail. Tony is asking, is this scene from Ravenhill? Possibly. Ravenhill, as it's described in the book anyway, is more of a lookout post and less of a sort of outcropping like this. Anyway, I'm not sure, but it's possible. So this is.
But you're right, Corey. I mean, these three visions, like Kate was just saying too. I mean, you've got these itty bitty, you know, dwarves and hobbit with three scenes of enormous grandeur.
Yes.
Like you say, the mountain, the statue, and now Dale. It's pretty sweeping.
Yeah, yeah. And Sarah was just, you know, saying it's like, you know, getting a kind of, you know, Argonath vibe, you know, with the huge dwarf king statue. Yeah, and I mean, even right. remembering that passage in the book, you know, where the response by Frodo and Sam is, you know, they feel terribly oppressed going under, you know, they feel diminished and terrified going through the Argonath. But then there's Aragorn in the rear of their boat saying, "Fear not," right? And obviously taking great encouragement at the sight of, you know, the kings of old, in whose footsteps he's following and whose legacy he has arrived to fulfill. And so there's clearly, I mean, I've, you know, made before lots of, you know, Thorin Aragorn parallels, and I think that they're clearly there. And it kind of looks like, I mean, even visually, I can't imagine that Peter Jackson and his team think that the moviegoers are not going to be thinking of the Argonath too, when they look at those statues. So that parallel, I think, is pretty striking, though less was made of it in the Lord of the Rings films than is made of it in the book. But
out of curiosity, have we considered the possibility that all of this stuff that we think is snow, it might be ash?
Well, but there's ice on the lake in that.
Yeah, there was ice floating in the lake. And I wouldn't think that ash would.
But what about as we get closer to the mountain?
I wouldn't think that ash would sit like that. That is
probably not.
Like it wouldn't drift in that way. I wouldn't think. I mean, I, you know, it's not like I am.
Tony agrees. Yeah.
Intimate familiarity of volcanoes, but from what I understand of ash fall, I don't think it's going to lie like that.
It would blanket everything.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. It would be like a film over things.
Yeah,
but...
Okay, fine. My geology degree.
Okay, so Dave, D-May is trying to bail you out and suggesting that maybe dragon ash is different from volcanic ash.
Yes,
so there you go,
be.
Dave. It's possible. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
Exactly. I knew it. So now let's go back and actually listen to the voiceover here, leading up into the Thranduil scene.
Does your journey end? You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule. quest to reclaim a homeland and slay a dragon.
Okay, now two things. You seek that which would give you the right to rule.
Right, the Arkenstone, right?
It's got to be the Arkenstone. It's got to be the Arkenstone.
Really, yeah. Really going back to that whole divine
right
divine
thing.
Divine sort of countenance, right thing that they set up in the prologue.
Absolutely. And that's fascinating because the way...
T-Bay says, it's back!
That's right.
The way that the Arkenstone was talked about in film... I mean, obviously it was connected in that line, that, you know, famous or notorious line among Tolkien fans and filmgoers of the divine right. That's present, but... The way it was presented in the first film almost made it sound like that was a Thror thing. That, like, Thror considered it that way. Like, this is how Thror liked to think of it. In Thror's mind, it was connected with his throne. The fact that Thranduil is talking this way, as if Thranduil concedes the fact that whoever has the Arkenstone has the right to rule, that, to me, throws the whole thing in a different light.
Thor doesn't even mention it in movie one. I mean, he doesn't... He never really brings it up, right?
I don't recall him mentioning it.
Right.
No.
There's no discussion of it other than in the prologue.
No.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, and this goes back to when we were talking about the interactions between Thorin and Thranduil a couple episodes ago. One of the questions was, look, if he's the rightful heir, and it's not going to be disputed that he's the rightful... If he's going to be recognized as, why shouldn't he be, by Thranduil, as the grandson of Thror and the rightful heir of the kingship, and if he has, in some sense, which is not totally obvious and clearly not connected to the book, if he in some sense owes fealty to the king of Erebor, then how can he possibly justify... not helping Thorin. I mean, if he's, oh, hi, my king, I'm going to keep you in prison. I mean, that becomes a huge deal. But if he's actually suggesting, hey, Mr. Arkenstoneless wannabe king, I don't have to do anything unless you're holding the Arkenstone. That's both a little bit bizarre, but also really puts things on a different footing.
Well, and plus Thorin, it could be just a tactical... decision on his part not to talk about the Arkenstone, because it sounds a lot better. We're going to go and slay the dragon rather than I'm going to go back and get the Arkenstone so I can be the king.
Right, right.
That's selfish. That's pretty consistent with the book too, right? Like the first we hear of the Arkenstone is when Thorin's running around looking for it in them. You know, it's not like they're not singing about it at Bag End.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
Right. And that, yes, exactly. And now it's one of those things which, you can see as kind of like in some ways a kind of accident of how the story evolved. Tolkien didn't think of the Arkenstone until that stage of the story. So there's no reference to it earlier on, but no, you're right. I mean, it's not until right before, after Bilbo goes in the first time and brings back the cup and they're talking about all the treasures in there, that's when Thorin mentions the Arkenstone and we hear about it for the first time. And then Bilbo finds it and we get the description of it and we see Bilbo's interaction with it when he puts it in his pocket. And then we get Thorin becoming rapidly Arkenstone obsessed as he goes through. But of course, the other thing I said, there were two things in that section that bit of voiceover, which really jump out. The Arkenstone reference is the one. The other is the latter part, to me, is the latter part that he cites Thorin's quest's goals as to regain a kingdom and to slay a dragon. And those are the two things that are almost never mentioned in the book. In the book, it's all about the treasure. It's all about recovering the gold. From the beginning, that's the whole point. As a point I've made lots of time, Bomber characterizes their whole trip as a treasure hunt. That's what they're about. And of course, we were we discussed, and when we were talking about film one, the very remarkable, you know, sort of dramatic way in which the films depart from that by emphasizing the bigger picture stuff. Whereas in the book, slaying the dragon is like literally the last thing on the minds of any of the dwarves. In fact, they quite omit to think about this and plan for it, as Bilbo feels inclined to point out. That it had always been a weak point in their plans.
The books are more of a children's book, where a treasure hunt sounds, it's very much something a child could relate to. Oh, we're going to have a treasure hunt. We might run into a dragon, but we're really, you know, we're going to look for treasure.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Exactly. And you know, and it's more of the sort of fairy tale story. You know, to set out on a quest for you know, the long lost treasure of the dwarves. But anyway,
I have a thought.
It's fascinating that Thranduil characterizes it that way.
There's also the possibility, this is a little far-fetched, okay, but there's also the possibility that Thorin doesn't know until Thranduil actually says this to him, that in order for him to get, you know, regain the fealty or regain the allies as king of the mountain, he has to have the Arkenstone. I mean, it could be he doesn't know until Thranduil actually has this conversation with him.
So
far-fetched. What a possibility.
Well, you know, I could imagine that at least as a kind of political gambit on Thranduil's part, basically him standing on a technicality in order to try to get out of his fealty. Like, oh, wait, you know, I could see Thorin, you know, looking like this, saying, I am your king. What do you think you're doing? And Thranduil being like, oh, actually, technically, you're not my king because you don't hold the Arkenstone. Sorry. I could see that.
I want to weigh in with a sort of counterbalance all of this. So it's possible, first of all, let's run with the Arkenstone. It's possible that it still doesn't have to do with Thranduil being subservient to the king under the mountain, but more of it, it's like the status quo is what it is and we're doing pretty good. And Thorin trying to reestablish himself as king, whether that means getting the Arkenstone or not, is just going to change things. That it's not so much Thorin setting himself up above the elves, but setting himself on par with them. Right now, he's kind of like the vagabond king, guy running around saying, I'm king under the mountain. Yeah, where's your mountain, buddy? We don't have to take you seriously. So it may not necessarily be fealty. It might just be, you know, Why do you know, like, by going and trying to reclaim your kingship, then I can treat you as something other than just like a guy who's trespassing in my forest. The other thing too is, it's possible that he's maybe talking more generally than Arkenstone. You know, after all, what is the thing that Thorin really needs to possess in order to be king? His kingdom. He actually has to have the kingdom under the mountain, right? Like, maybe that's what he's talking about. Oh, you're going to go, you know, you're going to take back the mountain so you can be king under the mountain again and be in charge and all that kind of stuff. Like, so maybe he's not actually talking about the Arkenstone, because that would be a pretty big change, because nobody really even knew about it.
But somehow the Arkenstone is going to have to get reintroduced. I mean, Neil Finn sang about it, so, I mean, it's got to be in the movie someplace.
Well, yeah, I think,
you know,
I mean, it will be.
So it's going to be, you know, I mean, I can't believe they wait until movie 3 to reintroduce
I think it will be, but I don't think it necessarily has to be like, you know, I don't think the soul, I don't think it's guaranteed that Thranduil's, yeah, always have to be careful with trailers, right?
Like, yeah, no, it's true, but.
And they present it out of context, and sometimes they even put things in there that don't even end up in the final.
Yeah, but then it's no fun.
Right.
I mean, we've got to be creative here.
Seems to me that the Arkenstone is going to have to take on some new characteristics, because, you know, a pretty jewel doesn't usually make for a king. You know.
Yeah, but see, it's as
spectacular as it is,
right,
you know,
right.
It's not a Silmaril, it's not the One
right,
Ring.
Right, right. Or
I,
is
I,
it?
I just, but I think for me, the main thing is less whether it's about the Arkenstone or not, or the fealty thing. I don't buy that was the actual relationship. That's a pretty big change. That's not even consistent with the previous films, right? Because if that was really true, shouldn't Legolas have been deferring to Gimli throughout the film?
Well, let's see how things...
It doesn't even have to be fealty. It could just simply be, you know, that Thorin knows he needs Thranduil's acknowledgement of him as king under the mountain.
But let's not be hasty. Let's see how things settle out politically after the Battle of Five Armies before we think about that.
Maybe that was the previous relationship.
Exactly.
In the world to come, they'll decide to be peers.
Or something.
In some respect, it doesn't matter. It's fairly obvious that the more general thing is that what Thranduil is getting at is you're going to go and try to set yourself up as king under the mountain. Whether Thranduil was a vassal or not previously, it's going to change things if he goes and actually succeeds. And more than likely, he's going to fail and he's just going to screw everyone over and just upset the dragon.
Though I agree with your, you know, be cautious about investing too much in what is said in trailers because of context and everything, totally agree. It's the definiteness of that statement that gets to me.
Seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule.
You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule. It can't be the kingdom he's talking about, because that is the ruling. It's not the thing that gives you the right to rule. You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule.
That doesn't mean he means rule me or rule us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be a king anywhere. But I agree. You're right. It really does kind of sound like he's talking about.
But of course, you are right about the radicalness of that change. It's something, you know, that set off so many alarm bells for everybody when you saw the first film. I mean, as soon as it said divine right, you know, like, you could hear like Tolkien fans everywhere reeling back and saying, what the heck is going on here? It's a big deal. We should move on to talking. I mean, we sort of, in listening to this passage, we sort of skipped past this visually. This is clearly inside the halls of the Elven King, which is our first glimpse of that. I really like the fact you can see kind of visual echo, like in the way that the columns are done and up here, of, you know, the kind of like, you know, the Rivendell architecture, and even some of the work in Lothlorien. So it definitely like looks elvish, and yet it is clearly underground. You know, there are definite echoes of Erebor as well.
I think it's really cool because they've got the tree roots.
Yeah, they did a great job.
With Lothlorien, it was all up in the tree boughs, which I think is really an interesting, you know, contrast.
I'm going to be honest with you. It took me about a minute to figure out where the heck this was.
Right.
No, seriously. Like, first look, I was like, okay, where the heck is this? Like, I started to wonder if, like, it can't be the Lonely Mountain. There's too many people. And I was like, oh, wait, there's a lot. Those look like elves. Oh, it must be the Elven King's Kingdom.
It's Minigroth.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's where I really started thinking. I was like, this is totally Minigroth, man. That's what they're really going for. I mean, I don't know if that's what Peter Jackson's going for, but that's totally the image that's invoked in my mind. Like, this is how I pictured, Menengrad, yeah.
And
yeah,
I think
that's a whole different scale than the Elven King's Hall.
Yes.
It's much bigger.
I think that they have done, and this is no surprise. I mean, you know, anybody who complains about the films, like, that's fine. But the one thing that I think is sort of most obviously excellent about the films is, you know, Alan Lee and John Howe's visual design. They've done such a good job.
Yeah.
It's not that I like the design of absolutely everything and every character in the films, but especially their settings and landscapes have been fantastic from the very beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring. And what they have done brilliantly here is answer the question that so many people have, which is, why do the elves live underground? Or rather, like, how can you picture these caves that elves live in? Elves being so, you know, like, Lothlorien makes sense, right? The city in the trees, with the trees, you know, one with the trees, that seems like a very elvish thing. But it does, living in caves underground does not seem like a very Tolkien elf thing to do. It certainly for many people, you know, for those who are Silmarillion fans, it seems a little bit more familiar, because you've got both Nargothrond and Menegroth to use as models. But nevertheless, it seems counterintuitive. And how are you going to depict it? You know, because it would just be weird to have, you know, Legolas's people living in a place that looks like Moria, or a place, or even a place that looks like Erebor. So we see what they've done. Light. Look at all the light. We've got windows in these underground caves. And green. We've got growing things inside the caves.
Trees.
Tree roots.
A stream, for crying out loud.
I feel like once you've spent enough time in the Silmarillion, that sort of you sort of disabused that notion that elves are tree livers. Like, that's a very Dungeons and Dragons sort of, you know, distillation of a Lord of the Rings films thing. Like, after you've read through Silmarillion enough times, you start to realize actually a lot of them lived in caves, or actually they lived in a lot of different places: caves, mountains, trees, cities. They're basically just like men in that sense. So
of course we cross the streams, you know, we cross the streams here, because I don't think Legolas said it in the movie, did he, that the thing about when Gimli raves about the caves there at Helm's Deep, and Legolas and he have that conversation, and Legolas can't understand why Gimli would care so much. And I think you've said that before, Corey, haven't you? It's like, well, if Legolas lives underground, why would he be so surprised that Gimli's reading about the caves? But I don't think he does it in the movie, though. I don't think they have that conversation.
No, he doesn't. And, of course, even then in the book, Gimli teases him about that. He says, like, you know, do you think those caves that you live in are beautiful? Well,
right.
And of course, he adds, as a writer, and dwarves helped in their making long ago. But it's clear that Legolas doesn't invest much in the beauty of his underground caves. You know, his reaction is certainly not, and when he hears Gimli talking, his reaction is certainly not, oh yeah, I love caves. I'd love to see them, because I'm a big cave fan myself. I live in a cave. I was born in a cave. So you're right. I mean, he doesn't have that reaction. He doesn't seem to think much about it.
Well, the dwarves seem to love the beauty of the rocks and the crystals and the stones they find in the cave. But this cave is very much carved to look like living trees and living things.
I wonder if we're being too narrow with our understanding of the word cave. You know, maybe the difference is that the elven caves are sort of caves and only in the technical sense, but they're not at all the way the kinds of caves that a dwarf would consider to be a cave. Like, this certainly looks very different visually than Moria.
Yeah, and it's certainly
like tree roots.
Right, exactly. This is not necessarily the kind of cave which is like, you know, a large hollow inside, you know, deep inside a mountain. They're obviously not deep inside. And it looks like you could easily imagine portions of this that are actually open to the air, you know, that this is not just, this is not a massive subterranean complex so much as like a secret area inside the hills that, you know, some of which is underground and some of which might not be.
I mean, if you think about Lothlorien too, there's a canopy overhead that is covering a lot of the light. So, you know, if you took away the roof, this could almost be like Lothlorien. It looks a lot like Lothlorien, just carved out of stone instead of living trees.
Right. Now, Ed asks the very sensible question, which is often, quite a good question, really. Why do you recreate a forest under a forest? That is, if you wanted to be among the trees, why not just go among the trees? Why be in a cave in the first place? And I mean,
for safety.
Exactly. That's always been the answer to that. It's a stronghold, and you know, it's, you know, more defensible than a forest. is, and that seems to be the primary reason. But it is, but Ed, I mean, I do recognize that there does seem to be kind of an irony to be like, let's make a cave. Hey, I know. Let's pretend we're in a forest. Oh, wait, actually, we are in a forest. We could just go outside. But
the other odd thing is, I mean, this looks like it took a long time to carve out.
Yes.
And if Greenwood the Great has just recently become evil, would the elves have really needed this kind of cave?
Well, I mean, it's... See, I think
that's where the Menengroth...
Exactly, that's what I was just going
to
say.
Yeah, see, the halls of the Elven King in the original Hobbit book weren't for secure... I mean, they had already existed.
Yeah.
Even when Greenwood the Great was Greenwood the Great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, though in the Hobbit book, there's not really a Greenwood concept.
Well, right.
At least right. Not at the beginning. But still.
Well,
not...
and I mean, in the Hobbit, it's actually, I mean, in the Hobbit, there is no need for security, right? I mean,
well, there's...
Beverly doesn't enter into it.
I mean, I guess it does just sort of go back to the Menegroth model. I mean, stronghold and fortress are two words that are used in the Hobbit.
The elven idea, or almost in their genetic memory, I suppose you could call it, of having a stronghold that's hard to find from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right,
in a forest,
right.
A cave is a good way to do that.
Right, yeah. James asks a good question. Do they all live underground, or is it just the king's home and a refuge for the people when needed? I could easily see it being done that way. That especially, even the book kind of invites that with, you know, the sound of the elvish voices that they hear through the trees and the woodland feasts that they stumble upon. It's clear that it's not like they, you know, stay underground all the time, or even most of the time necessarily. So one could easily imagine if the land of the wood elves in The Hobbit was more thoroughly envisioned, one could easily imagine that many of them would be living most or all of their time above ground, and the halls of the Elven King are really just the fortress and stronghold and the royal
right.
seat. That to me makes perfect sense, though Tolkien didn't really spell that out, certainly not in The Hobbit. But yeah,
I have a slight change of direction on this visual. Yana asked the question, do the dwarves look like they had their hands bound? And I can't really tell that, but they definitely are being escorted by elven
here, like, right?
Guards. Yeah.
It
right?
looks oh, it's
going across the bridge there.
To reclaim a homeland.
No, they're swinging their arms, but they're definitely being escorted
right.
by a strong
okay.
by
yeah.
a strong force. Yeah. And we can look at them again here.
Sharon Hoff helped us out here.
Quest to
reclaim Homeland. Yeah. No, they're not.
Oh, okay, there we go.
They don't seem to be bound there in the
yeah.
pictures.
Being escorted. So Sharon found in The Hobbit where it says, in fact, the subjects of the king mostly lived and hunted in the open woods.
Okay, yes.
That's from the book.
Certainly hunted, yes. Okay, good. Okay.
Slay a dragon.
Oh, and of course, one, this was pointed out early on, that is, early on, I say, by which I mean hours ago, by people, you know, with whom I was chatting about this over Facebook and over Twitter, one question that we've been asking this season so far is definitively answered here. And that is Thorin going to be captured separately, or is he going to be with them when they're taken by the spiders?
Right.
His liberal covering with cobwebs certainly, I think, answers that question here.
Yeah.
Which I still find kind of a disappointment. I'm certainly not surprised by it. But in fact, didn't I predict that way back at the beginning of season one that Thorin would be there for the spider fight? But
I think you did.
I think I did. But anyway, I'm a little bit sad that that came true, because I would have liked to see the separate confrontation. But And it will still be interesting. I know, I remember the issue we were discussing back at the beginning of that, that is back at the beginning of season one, was how are they going to do Bilbo's heroism among the spiders without diminishing Thorin? You know, if Studley King Thorin has to play the like damsel in distress role that Bilbo comes and rescues, what does that do to his character arc? So I'll still be interested to see how they handle that.
Yeah.
Ed is of course teasing us for having an hour long podcast on 20 seconds of video so far.
And he shouldn't be surprised. He's a Mythgard student. He should know better.
Exactly. So we are on pace for a 6-hour episode here.
This is pretty bad. I was going to respond to him by saying that Father Roderick and Inga and I took hours on analyzing the first film, but if we're on pace for 6 hours, that's even worse.
On a 2-minute trailer, yeah. So let's see if we can step it up a little bit. So, okay, back to Thranduil. Okay, can I just say that they really need to be wearing helmets? That looks so unsafe. I mean, seriously. Yeah. Public safety message. Kids, don't try this at home, because holy cow. The odds that your neck remains unbroken while it's sticking out of a barrel that is rolling off a precipice like that. Okay.
I don't think they'll be making a Lord of the Rings Land ride.
I think they will.
That's the first thing I thought of when I saw them.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You will be wearing a helmet, or there'll be a cage over you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I promised that I would not get too obsessed about the fact that these butterflies are blue, but let's just get it out of our system now. These are supposed to be black butterflies. Okay.
Black butterflies.
That's it. Okay. I'm done. It's fine. Kate says it's just the lighting. Yeah. No. Now, I don't deny that visually it's lovely. And of course, the way in which the blue butterflies are connected with the blue sky and Bilbo, like, not having seen the sky or the sun, and you've got the sun on the autumnal leaves and the brilliant blue butterflies echoing the color of the blue sky that he hasn't seen, and the wind, blowing his hair. You know, it's a lovely moment. They've done it well visually, and I will try not to weep over much for the Black Emperors.
Pete suggests the Barrels Out of Bond ride, as well as the Denethor's Death Leap bungee jump.
Hey. That sounds good, but would they have to actually set you on fire first before you did that?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be an insurance hazard, I would have to think. Okay.
I'm like a flame retardant jumpsuit.
Yes. First we douse you in lighter fluid, and then we push you off a cliff.
Maybe to get back on track a little bit. I'm always doing this to Trish.
That's true. Yes.
If they were black butterflies, they would look like bats, kind of.
Yes.
They?
Yes, they would. No, I do suspect that if those butterflies were black, visually it would look odd.
It probably just wouldn't work.
In the scene as they've depicted
it
there.
They may have actually tried black butterflies and it didn't work. So, maybe they tried.
I can see it.
Unreliable narrator. They actually were blue. Bilbo got it wrong.
Exactly. Who's to say that it's the movie that's wrong and the book that's right?
We can throw the whole book out.
How can these barrels not get full of water going through rapids like that?
I'm having
a hard time suspending my disbelief.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know that it's more engaging visually than just a barrel going down.
Well, right. Yeah.
Is it more ridiculous than these guys surviving in sealed barrels?
Well, see, yeah, I mean, that,
true.
That is an issue, and but yeah, Laura and I were chatting about this earlier. Certainly, visually speaking, dramatic shots of sealed up barrels bumping their way down a river is really not that much to look at, even less to look at.
The only way they could do it was they'd have to add a layer of sound over it where we could hear what was going on in the barrel, so they were going, oh, ow, ugh.
Yeah.
And that would be ridiculous.
And that would be comical, but And then, of course, I guess you could mix it up by having the, like, barrel cam, like, shots from the dwarves' point of view of pitch darkness while they're being jostled around.
That would be really
useful. Yeah, so, I mean, one can certainly understand how visually it is much better to have them actually sticking out of the barrels. But though it does also answer my other question. Remember when we were talking about the barrels before, and Trish, you were saying there that it mentioned them being wine barrels, and I was saying that's impossible. Well, no, it's not impossible if their tops are open. I mean, the point I was making is that you can't reseal a wine barrel once you pop the end off. But if you're not resealing it, then fine. Yeah, by all means,
solve that problem.
Exactly, no problems.
Now, Sharon brings up a point that we actually talked about. Oh, who's that? Sharon brings up a point that we talked about last year, too, which is if this is supposed to be their commerce route between, you know, the Elven King's Hall and Lake Town, how do they get back up the river?
Yeah, this does not look like a let's pull the barrels down to Lake Town today kind of river.
No.
A river is not exactly what you would call navigable. But, you know, hey.
Also, right. if this is a main commerce route, it looks pretty insecure.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Looks prone to, looks vulnerable to banditry.
Yeah. Right, like, for instance, CGI elves scampering around on branches.
And also maybe goblins or orcs or zomborks.
Yeah, if we get really lucky. One quick question about... Okay, so now this is Mirkwood, obviously. We're getting an earlier Mirkwood shot. One thing I just noticed when I paused it, what's this? Is that just nothing? Didn't that look like a person? Is that just an optical illusion on my part?
Where?
This, right here. Is there something in the foreground?
I think that's an optical illusion.
Okay, it's just a thing.
But now that you've said that, my brain has overfit and decided it's a person.
That's probably
it
just
look like. I think it does look like people.
It does.
It's Bellatrix Lestrange.
Whatever.
It looks
okay.
Looks like they're looking that way.
Yeah. No, probably nothing. Okay, anyway, so here we are back to the party in Mirkwood here. So now this is, you know, people were worried that Mirkwood is too dark. Of course, this much light should not be shining through Mirkwood. And also, you know, notice that they have opted for the dead tree look rather than the dense and impenetrable canopy of leaves look. One defense that, again, is to be made here, this is a visual medium, people, so, like, you know, spending, like, 15 to 20 minutes of movie time in a place of almost impenetrable darkness is not going to look very good on screen. It's just not. I can understand them having some more light and instead going for the dead and blasted forest look rather than the totally dense and impenetrable forest look. But I do certainly understand people being concerned about all the rays of sunlight coming through into Mirkwood here. Oh, Yana suggests that this is Tom Bombadil. I think that's probably correct, yeah.
Yes,
I'm thinking they might be elves.
They didn't put him in the other films,
right?
So what
exactly.
They've decided the correct way to use him is to add him into a movie he's not in.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, Courtney says I like the way the vines look like they're choking the life out of the trees. I agree, and that's one of the really, really memorable descriptions of Mirkwood. When the description of the sort of gateway at the beginning of Mirkwood emphasizes that, and you know, like the trees are, you know, the vines are killing the trees, and the trees are killing each other. It is a very sort of fierce place in that way. So I don't think it's totally beyond the pale to describe it in this kind of a dead forest way.
Yeah, and Dave, I think that Peter Jackson's next project is going to be The Adventures of Tom Bombadil.
Oh, man. Yeah. We can only hope. I mean, like, my life would be complete.
Could that be an orc? Could that be what orc they're looking at in there?
It doesn't look very orky.
No, it really doesn't. It's probably nothing.
Elves. I'm thinking it's elves that are hiding.
It also doesn't look like an elf. It really doesn't look like anything.
Yes. Although, no, it's probably not. I think it's interesting
it looks
that
like a person, just not any person that would appear in this film.
Right. Maybe it's a cameraman. It's interesting the terrain that they have here, that they, you know, they've opted against a, you know, we're just going across a forest floor. I mean, there were no cliffs or anything like that.
Mountains and cliffs.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be more rugged terrain, which is okay. I mean, there were hills and mountains in Mount Fuji.
By the way, have you also noticed what's not in this? I mean, obviously, you know, we don't have Stephen Fry in this, but we also don't have any scene in this trailer of, you know, a bomber falling in and them having to carry him around Mirkwood.
Ah, the Black River.
Just, I mean,
yeah,
he'll probably show up in another one. But I also thought it was interesting we don't see the Master, which makes me think they may have another trailer.
Yeah, I would. There's got to be a Stephen Fry trailer. There has to be. Can I just say that?
That was a funny suggestion.
Sorry, I was just going to point out that at the very least, this segment could be used as an excellent Little League Baseball instructional video. That's an excellent pop-up slide that Legolas just did.
Oh, that's true.
His form is really quite good. So, you know, at the very least, we have that extra function here.
That's true.
And here's the dwarfs being captured.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right after they've emerged. So, and this actually kind of... You know, remember there was that whole controversy, Dave, it was one of the things that you and I were so bothered by way back at the beginning of season one, the idea that Legolas is going to come and rescue them from the spiders. That does not look like that's happening here.
No, you're right.
This looks like how it happens in the book. That is, they have just escaped the spiders, and the elves capture them when they're fresh after having escaped the spiders. Mm-hmm. And maybe they add the elves to the tail end of the action sequence and have them to help disperse the spiders after the dwarves have already escaped. But this hardly looks like we're here to cut you free from the webs. So
no, you're right.
Good news.
I'm pretty sure if Thorin's holding Orcharist, we can conclude that the dwarves have successfully defended themselves at least for a while.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. He is not looking helpless here.
And it's not like Legolas turned. It's not like Legolas was shooting spiders and then turned around and said, "By the way, you're captured."
Right.
He came running out of nowhere.
Yep. Yep.
So Bilbo perhaps has already put the ring on at this point, and
yes, I would suspect so. Can I also just add that anybody who carries a weapon like that has no right to criticize Bilbo for using a letter opener? What is that? Like, I've got like a 3-inch blade. Back off. I could probably safely carry this onto an airplane and pass through security, but get out of my way.
They forgot to put the spiders too.
And then you've got Bolfer in the background carrying what? Like a plank? I mean, what is that? I mean, like, I got a piece of twisted wood here and I'm not afraid. And he's got this awesome, like, expression on his face. Like, come here, I'll give you a piece of this big old whatever it is I'm carrying. This is just a great shot right here.
Maybe only Thorin got a sword.
No yeah, way. Exactly.
Yeah, it looks like no one's got a weapon except for Thorin.
Yeah, yeah. Which is interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll get Legolas' bright blue eyes here.
Do not think I won't kill you, dwarf.
Okay.
What the heck is going on here?
Yeah.
When did we allow...
Okay, before we get to Toriel, this is a bear.
Yeah, it's odd they put this scene in. They're trying to throw you off.
Yeah.
This has got to be... That's Bjorn.
That's a bear.
That's a bear.
Yeah.
I was having a long discussion on Twitter about this.
Yeah.
And not only is this a bear... This has got to be Bjorn. Look how freaking big that bear is.
It's got to be Bjorn.
I know. It's got to be Bjorn.
I mean, yes, the book says there are gigantic big bears that are around outside. Now, just to sort of contextualize, I was having this debate on Twitter about, like, what exactly is going on here. My like, optimal case theory would be that the bear they are trying to hold out is one of the bears, one of the nocturnal guardians of Bjorn's house, that this is not, in fact, them, for some reason, fighting Bjorn, but rather, you know, like, Bjorn says, hey, don't leave the house because it's dangerous at night, and they're like, yeah, whatever, and they go out and are almost attacked by a bear and run back inside and barely escape, and Bjorn comes back and says, dude, I told you not to leave the house. That would be my, like, optimal wish fulfillment version of this scene. But yeah, looking, but too. That's totally
can you,
Bjorn.
Can you tell if it's? Can you tell if it's nighttime?
Suppose it's.
I can't.
Suppose it's a Goldilocks situation.
Candles are on.
They came upon the house and it was a bit and it, no one was home and they went in and then Bjorn showed up.
That is possible.
Well, we do have the scene of them running through the front door. We have the scene from the video
log. Maybe Bjorn is chasing them
in the front, so it could be. But you know, the thing I couldn't figure that out was why would Bjorn be chasing them into his own house? Oh, I'm not sure.
Certainly, it seems like it must be this. This must be how they're going to meet, and obviously, that they start things off with a misunderstanding that involves Bjorn chasing them or attacking them, whether he chases them into his house or whether they were in his house and he found them there and attacks. But it seems pretty clear that this must be how they're going to meet.
Yes. And I agree with Tony's comment, that Gandalf does always, you know, go on in the book about how dangerous Bjorn is. I mean, Gandalf gives them the very clear sense that, you know, we're going to go, the person that we're about to go talk to is very powerful and pretty volatile. There's like a non-zero chance that we could get attacked by something quite scary in, you know, the next hour or two. Like, that's always kind of on the table with Bjorn, that he could take things very badly, and because he's a bad enemy, and he is not yet their friend. So, you know, I can see this as a kind of exaggeration of that. It's a little bit harder to see how this is going to get smoothed over. You know, hard to see how we do a nice, pleasant round of introductions and end up with him as their friend. Now, of course, we could have, it could be setting up an interesting sort of arc for Bjorn, where it starts off with them trying to, you know, bar the door against him here. And at the end, we get him at the gates of Erebor fighting in the Battle of Five Armies alongside them. You know, you could make an interesting kind of correspondence.
Well, Gandalf is kind of the diplomat when they meet Bjorn. So, and we don't see Gandalf here. So
yeah.
He's going to step in somehow.
That's a good question. Is Gandalf even here yet? Does he leave before Bjorn?
Yeah, Brianna can remind me of this, but I'm pretty sure in the action when they're running away from something, yeah, he's there. Now I'm going to go back to I don't necessarily know that this is Bjorn. I mean, this could be like his bear guard. I mean, they may get the door closed, and Bjorn may be standing behind him saying, "Oh, you got past the guard, I see," or something like that. You know, I mean, so, I can't get it. How if this is Bjorn and they lock him out of his own house, how do we get them to him being a host?
Yeah, no,
he's so big though.
It's got to be Bjorn.
I like the comment Bilbo said furrier a little too loudly, apparently.
Yeah, I was thinking that Sam's comment. Yeah, I was looking at that one. That's why I was laughing just a second ago. I just saw that. Yeah, exactly. Or maybe he said cape, tippet, or muff, perhaps. Well, so, I mean, there's not too much to go on here as far as trying to figure out what's actually happening or certainly how they're going to come out of this. But that they're having a rather alarming confrontation with Bjorn seems at least highly probable here. And this is an awesome Martin Freeman face, can I just say?
Yep. I don't think this isn't like an offensive change in
no.
my opinion. Like,
no, I don't, again, especially since emphasizing that Bjorn is really dangerous and unpredictable is in keeping with the spirit of that passage in the book. So, yeah, I mean, like, is it going more over the top? Yeah. Is that a surprise? No. And anyway, like, in a film, you have to be a little less understated about some of these things.
Right. I think it's a show, don't tell thing.
Like, exactly.
It just won't work to have Bjorn, to have Gandalf warn and say, hey, this guy's really dangerous, don't make him mad. He's serving us food, he's got walking, talking animals, I don't know about it. Don't go out, there's bears out there, but we never see them.
Right.
It's another thing to just have a giant bear attack them. Okay, yeah, we got it.
Right. Right. Okay, dangerous, check. Got it, yes. Okay, let's look at Toriel. Let's just start off with the visuals here before we get her actual conversation with Legolas, which is what we're getting into. So we've got her apparently in the halls of the Elven King here.
You see Tony Mead's comment? Basically, Bjorn is the Hulk.
Right. You wouldn't like him when he's angry, right?
He's angry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Exactly. Okay. So we've got the Toriel looking through.
Checking out Keeley.
Yeah.
He's checking out Keeley.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, yes. The thought bubble here is, gosh, that dwarf is hot. Right, yeah, okay. That is one hot dwarf.
She's going to have to take our poll. Our conundrum.
And then, okay, now we have her in motion. And she, here, like, is she supposed to be riding on something? I guess not, but.
I thought she's just walking.
But with great and remarkable fluidity. Then we get this shot of Lake Town, which is cool, by the way. I think this is a really neat Lake Town. I am a fan of this Lake Town, having it be more. In Tolkien's pictures, it's more of a single thing. That it's like you've got the piles and the beams out over the lake,
like,
but it's like
kind
one big square. This is more of a like a Venetian feel, right? Where each house is individually built up on piles, and you've got the street, but you've got the boat streets that go in the middle of it. I think that's cool.
It's more like Venice, isn't it? So this is the boat arriving.
Climate change is going to wreak havoc on them.
Oh man, yeah.
You can see barrels on this boat.
What it reminded me of is if anyone's ever seen pictures of Olesen in Norway.
No.
Sort of like this, sort of Nordic looking. They call it the Venice of the North because they've got.
Oh, wow.
It's right on the ocean.
Cool.
It's really cool.
Cool. Yeah. Philip was just pointing out that Lake Town is huge, which is true. It's way bigger than we're led to understand, I think, in the book. But actually, in some ways, that makes a lot of sense because. We're supposed, especially at the end, when we're supposed to understand that the portion of the survivors of the destruction of Lake Town make up one of the armies in the Battle of Five Armies, we've got to be able to have some populace. So making this into a town which is going to be sort of like Dale in its magnitude, rather than just being a little cluster of houses on the edge of the lake, is I think a pretty good visual change here.
It's also going to look incredible when the whole thing's set on fire.
Yeah,
I just thought the same thing, Dave.
Yep, absolutely.
Great when smog falls in the middle of it.
Yeah, though how's he going to? I mean, he's going to have to really roll around a lot to destroy this whole town when he lands on it, boy. Or maybe he's going to have to come in at a really shallow angle.
Yeah.
I guess if he's got enough fire, he'll do okay.
Benedict Cumberbatch has experience doing this. He's already crashed a giant spaceship into San Francisco.
There you go. So okay. So that will come in handy, truly. But anyway, let's get back to. But we were talking about. Oh wait. Oh sorry. Actually, Trish, you were right, and Dime was also pointing this out. I hadn't noticed that. It does look like we have the barrels here in the boat.
Yep.
Yeah. This is the big boat that Bard brings them in on, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like
and I'm assuming they're probably they've hidden back into the barrels again. Yeah.
Yeah. Though how, since they had no lids. But let's not worry about that. Okay. Now.
Well, maybe they got out of the barrels before they picked them up.
Right. So they just picked up these bunch. They're like, why are there all these barrels that wash downstream?
Well, you know what I was thinking is maybe they do drop the barrels down the river to Lake Town. But maybe they come up a different way, like by pony or something like that.
Still, like with the river that rough, I mean, what percentage of the barrels are going to survive that trip? Like you'd think
must be very sturdy barrels.
Must be very sturdy barrels.
Jackson doesn't worry about that stuff, does
no.
he?
No, yeah. He really doesn't.
This is one of his solutions to the proliferation of dwarf characters. Maybe we just lost like a third or a quarter of them along the way.
Could you imagine? Could you, you know, yeah, yeah. Nope, sorry, Nori drowned. Yeah, oh well.
Yeah.
Too bad.
Beaufort got taken by the rocks.
So we have Toriel and Legolas looking out at Lake Town, which is quite a ways out into the middle of the lake. This must be a very shallow lake or built on enormously long piles. But that's okay, I suppose. But I guess we have the two of them leading the expeditionary force of tree branch hopping elves that are in pursuit of the barrels, I guess, is what I'm...
Are these the people who chased after them to recapture them?
It kind of looks that...
That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like.
Tree branches
Yeah, it looks like it's the end and they're looking at the barrels as they're gone out into the lake. Or
did they take anyone else with them?
Well, there were at least three in that tree jumping scene above the rapids.
One of them, too.
Yeah.
How did they not catch up with the dwarves right here? Because it's pretty still water.
Yeah.
So earlier somebody commented, and I got this idea got planned in my brain. I don't know if we actually saw this on screen. They intermixed the scenes of the barrels and the elves sprinting through trees with scenes of elves fighting goblins.
We're getting there. We're not there yet.
Yeah, getting there.
Are we supposed to interpret that to mean that the orcs were somehow part of this? Were the elves, in fact, actually escorting the dwarves and protecting them, maybe?
It looks like they were shooting at them. I mean...
That's what it looked like.
If the elves were actively helping them, they probably would have helped them an easier way than having them...
Trust us, you guys ride these barrels and we'll provide covering fire, and what could go wrong? Yeah, that would be awesome. No, that's a great plan. That's just what we'll do.
I hope they do that now.
Let's hang on with the orc combat scene until we get there. But let's not get to the pile of treasure, which I love. But we should do Toriel and Legolas's dialogue here.
What the heck are they talking about? This is not.
When did we allow evil to become stronger than us?
Stronger than we. Sorry.
It's
not our fight.
Yes. This is our fight.
Okay, so the question, Dave, is what is the fight in question, which is or is not theirs?
It's got to be the dragon. They must have found out somehow about
the orcs chasing them?
Yeah, see, I was thinking that too. I was thinking like Thorin and his return to his kingdom, right? That was my first thought. But then when we got to the we're fighting orcs for some reason portion of the trailer at the end, I started to doubt. This is, I think, one of those moments, Dave, that you were talking about like being wanting where I want to be cautious because we have so little context in which to interpret these comments. But
maybe Legolas is talking about the dragon and Erebor, and she's talking about how the orcs are mixing in with this.
Yeah, possibly that she's looking at the bigger picture, the dragon plus the goblins plus Dol Guldur, and saying, this is all a part of a bigger thing.
Lines aren't even from the same scene.
Maybe they're not looking at each other at all. They're actually not
even
standing.
Having a conversation. They never even talk on screen.
Yes, Toriel and Legolas never actually appear on screen together. It's just edited in.
There's not much of a romance. That was another conundrum.
They're
standing so far apart.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, but she definitely says in an interview there's some kind of romance. She doesn't specifically say legless, but she sure implies it in an interview. So.
But yeah, no, I agree.
That's TV.
This facial expression does not say I'm into you to me.
No, it does not.
Yeah, I mean...
I get the impression they're more like brother and sister.
Yes.
I mean, because she says they grew up together. And she
I recognize that facial expression.
from your sister.
From your sister, yeah. Yeah.
As long as it's not from your wife.
Right.
No, she gives it to me, too.
What are you talking about?
Right, but, Dime says this is definitely not a date. But... So one thing I think that we can, you know, whatever the context is and whatever is the fight that they are discussing, which, as I think we can see, is not absolutely certain, yet nevertheless, I think it's interesting. We were debating, you know, what was going to be, you know, when we were talking about Legolas and Thranduil's positions and, you know, what's Legolas going to be, what position is he going to be taking in relationship to the dwarves and in relationship to the Lonely Mountain and all of this stuff. They have, this trailer clearly places Toriel as the sympathetic figure and Legolas is not, which is a fascinating move for them to make. Since Legolas was such a fan favorite, if he's going to come off as like basically a racist jerk throughout much of this film, only perhaps to be, you know, redeemed maybe at the end or maybe not, because he's still a racist jerk when he gets to the Council of Elrond. That would be, I would find that very interesting.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what role Tariel is going to have with convincing them to bring an elf army up to the Lonely Mountain, if she's going to have a role in that.
Well, if in the book, the army's not there to help them, so that'll be interesting. Maybe she's going to help Bilbo try to convince all of them to just get along.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Diplomacy doesn't look like her forte, but I don't know. Maybe. And, okay, I'm just going to say it. I actually kind of like Toriel in this trailer. I'm sorry. I know I'm supposed to hate Toriel. I'm supposed to, like, like join in the universal groan about...
cast again.
I know, but you know, I thought she was cool. I'm actually looking forward to seeing more Toriel in this film. Disown me if you will, but it's the truth. I can't deny it.
Hey, so
I like her too.
I have an alternate theory about the role of the orcs in this. I think the orcs actually help the dwarves break out, which is great because that obviously means that the wood elves apparently don't learn their lesson, and then it happens to them again with Gollum.
I see. Right. So what? So we have, like, you know, Azog and Thorin are just like, actually, you know, we both hate Thranduil. Can't we get along? You know, and we have like a, you know, a touching, like, bromance, manly hug between Azog and Thorin.
Maybe it's the orcs that stuffed him into those barrels and threw him out in the river. Get rid of him.
This was actually a collusion between the elves and the orcs. It's a sport they play. They stuff their prisoners in barrels, send them down the river, and then shoot at them with their
dwarf. Different kind of dwarf tossing. Dwarf barreling.
Right. Right. Of course.
Oh, man, this needs to be a t-shirt.
What, dwarf baiting? Philip says 15 birds in 5 apple barrels. Yeah, Kate says that's the real theme park ride, shooting at the people in the barrels. Yeah, that would be excellent.
Yes, I like that idea.
Yeah,
the people in the barrels are other theme park owners.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so they give the bows to the people who have been already waiting for the ride for like 2 hours but haven't gotten there yet, and they can shoot at the people who are already on the ride. That would be so satisfying and cathartic, you know.
That's right.
It would be excellent.
And then that's a great idea. You're waiting in line this whole time just so you can get in the barrel and be shot at.
Yes, exactly.
Yana says nobody barrels a dwarf. Okay, all right,
so how far are we?
The horde, no problem, we're almost halfway through. Can I just say, like, I would say here in this scene, as in the first film, I am delighted by the appropriate amount of treasure. You know, if anybody who remembers that article that Forbes did estimating the financial worth of Smaug the Dragon, and the general outrage with which this was greeted by how much they undervalued the horde of Smaug. This is, I think, much closer. You know, the fact that Bilbo could slide down the hill of treasure like this seems to me entirely right.
Smaug very wisely put his wealth in precious metals and not in currency.
Exactly. And rather than stuffing it into his mattress, just went whole hog and made it into his mattress. So that's really perfectly seems fairly sound.
What if it's a trap?
Okay. Dol Guldur. The setup of this trailer makes it really hard to do, like, thematic, you know, separate discussions. But anyway, let's talk about Dol Guldur. So we get a little bit more thorough look at Dol Guldur here than we did before. That is, from here it looks larger than I remember seeing it in the first film. I think we're getting a different angle. And it looks like there's at least one part of it that could be something like functional, which wasn't obvious from the first film, where it mostly just looked like this bit. That is simply standing ruins with no even enclosed parts. But anyway, we'll see what this actually forebodes for the actual...
The Sun God was there, a trap.
Now, since they've put a shot of Dol Guldur, now that could be misleading, are we at the tombs of the Nazgul here, or are we at Dol Guldur? I think we've got to be at Dol Guldur here.
And where are the tombs of the Nazgul?
Oh, they're like on the other side of the mountain and about 1,000 miles away, but that's okay. Yeah. We can get there in a bunny sled in about half an hour, probably. So, so yeah, don't worry. But also, I'm at a weakness. I never saw the CinemaCon footage, but all of the reports out of CinemaCon described, because that was the very first time anybody saw Radagast. And so there was a lot of focus on that in the CinemaCon, post-CinemaCon discussion last year. And remember, the reports that were coming out of it were describing a scene where Gandalf is doing a solo exploration and Radagast kind of shows up and Gandalf has that exchange with him where he's like, you know, hey, what are you doing here? Or I, you know, might have known you would turn up or something like that. This is clearly a Gandalf and Radagast are going here together kind of scene, which is what leads me to think, plus the rather suggestive helicopter shot of Dol Guldur that was positioned in between their comments suggests that this is the two of them going there together on purpose. Have I struck you all dumb or have you lost your audio? I was about to ask.
Yeah, it's confusing. You know, the thing that they do at the High Fells and then the thing that they do at Dol Guldur. And then if it turns into the Battle of Dol Guldur, we know from what Philippa Boyan said at Comic-Con last year that Galadriel is involved in the Battle of Dol Guldur. So
Well, maybe they just haven't sent up the Galadriel signal yet.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. He hasn't, you know, taken her up on her offer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He still has to, Back in the Elven King's halls, obviously. Look how this is carved to look like a big tree branch or tree root. That's really cool. Just, again, the visuals here. And again, more sunlight down there in the caves.
Am I remembering right that Alan Lee has done some illustrations similar to this?
This looks very Alan Lee. I mean, you know, there are definitely... The columns look more John Howe-ish to me. But the, like, this part is very Alan Lee. At least, I mean, you know, I'm no expert, but, you know, from my familiarity with their art, that would be my guess.
So this is the art, this is the interior of Dol Guldur, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clearly.
Such is the nature of evil.
Yeah.
Eyebrows.
The and eyebrows. The I thought they looked funny until I saw this scene, and now I'm like, no, now I am completely convinced by the eyebrows. I mean, that is stunning.
I'm trying to get the frost, this fantasy frost.
It's just the light. It's like moonlight on Thranduil's eyebrows. You know, what could be more romantic than Thranduil's eyebrows in the moonlight?
It's right.
It looks like they did the same thing with his eyes that they did with Galadriel. I remember they said that they had multiple lights, you know, so they'd show up in her eyes.
Yeah, no, you've got the glint of his eyes, you know, just setting off the eyebrows. Oh, I'm telling you, this is the
so
shot
cool
right here. This is the Oscar clip for Thranduil's eyebrows, you know, when they are nominated for their Best Supporting Actor award.
Best eyebrows in a movie.
Absolutely.
What are you looking at here?
Well,
is that Legolas?
Well, it Legolas looks just like Legolas's knives, so I would think so.
That's him. Sure.
But I hope that in the credits, this guy is named the Pointing Elf. And because this is an awesome job that he's got here. He's like,
nature of evil.
I think they went that way, possibly because it's the only path. Yeah, completely.
I'm thinking it's the guy is telling him about the company.
Yeah.
Well, and that's... Yeah, that's
They're not in the hall. Sorry.
Is this where they came from, or because they escaped downriver? I'm thinking this is pointing out the encroaching evil of Mirkwood.
Well, this has got to be the gate, like in Tolkien's picture.
Yes, this reminds me a lot of Tolkien's picture.
Yeah. Of the gates to the Elven King's Hall.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And but of course we're leaving it, right? So we're seeing, and also all of the descriptions have a bridge over a river leading up to the external gates to the Elven King's Hall, and that looks like we got a little waterfall here. So it looks like down here we've got, you know, they're right now on the bridge over the, you know, the gorge with the river in. And this does, Laura, exactly thinking of Tolkien's drawing, his line drawing of the sort of rows of trees leading up to the path up to the gate.
Could this be preparing the scouting party that will eventually stumble upon the dwarves?
It's possible. I am really rather absurdly amused by the pointing elf, because it's just like,
yeah, what is he pointing?
He's standing at the front door pointing out the obvious path. Like, go that way, you know.
So they came up our driveway,
right? Exactly. Or like, you know, yeah, just keep going straight. You can't miss it. I mean, like, what? I really don't know what he's trying to do, but
it does look less gloomy than other parts of the forest.
Yes, and I was thinking, Dave, thinking of our riddle back a while ago about, is there going to be any physical demarcation between I think we have our answer. This looks nothing like, that picture of blasted woodland where I thought Tom Bombadil was hanging out. This looks nothing like that.
Right. Legolas's do. I want to see if I can do my hair like that.
This is pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Time or foul.
Now, that had to be.
Whoa.
This has to be the tomb of the Nazgul, right?
The tomb.
Yeah. Yes. It's the only time we see it in the whole trailer.
And there's the broken gates.
Yeah, we've seen this scene before.
Or at least, right. I haven't seen it, but I've heard it described. You know, where they come and they see, like, oh, it's broken open from the inside, right?
Oh, maybe you haven't seen it. Wasn't it in the behind-the-scenes footage?
It was in the preview footage from the DVD. I mean, you know, the live stream that we did.
Brianna's got it
in her thing, too.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah, they're looking down. They're actually looking down, so there's like 9 levels or whatever.
It's a really weird tomb, but, you know, it's all good.
Yeah,
I see the tombs are broken out from the inside.
Right, yeah. Right. So
Where is this?
Rudaur, they said. Which is like up in Arnor, but whatever. I am so not going to worry about geography. It doesn't matter. We can cross the Misty Mountains at will. It really doesn't matter.
It at Dol Guldur.
I wonder if it's been moved. Yeah,
because it's Radagast with Gandalf, right?
Is Radagast?
Galadriel talks about it being in the High Fells, but I don't. You know, she does. So she specifically said in the Council of Elrond. I'm not the Council of Elrond. The White Council meeting.
Yeah.
The High Fells, which to me meant, you know, that she's talking about a place that's different from Dol Guldur when she says that. Mm. Otherwise, why identify as something that's different? But maybe it's east of the mountains in this
movie. I will say that if they buried the Nazgul at Dol Guldur, seems like a poor choice.
yeah, exactly. We were thinking of just burying them in Barad-dûr or something because we couldn't actually find...
We're going to take them all the way back to Mordor.
Exactly, yeah, we were going to do that. And some people voted for going and trying to do, like, to discover, Thangorodrim. But whatever, we just decided we'd find the other most evil place we could find and bury them here because that seems logical. Yeah.
Also, a place where we can't keep an eye on them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep, yep. Any place totally inaccessible would do, but, we'll see.
This actually kind of seems like par for the course for Middle-earth.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so...
Okay, where are we here?
Now, these are elves?
Ooh, that guy's in trouble.
Yeah. Is this the top of the cave? Is this the top of the Elven King's Hall?
I think we're... People are assuming, yeah, it's the Elven King's Hall, and Azog and his henchmen are invading.
This looks like the place where Saruman's goblin men attack the Fellowship at the end of Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, and can I just say, like, you know, I'm not an expert on battle tactics, but if you're an archer on a wall, the best place to be looking and aiming is over the wall. Not at the floor, not inside the ground. You should probably not stand with your back to the wall that you're defending, just as a
Isn't
general
he being
tip.
Tackled by somebody?
He's about to be tackled, but he's not yet, and he wouldn't be tackled if he were looking where the enemy was coming from.
Well, what's going on to the left there? Is that somebody tackling another elf?
Yes, this is another goblin and another elf here, so one is already being tackled.
What is he aiming at?
I don't know. But this tree was making a funny move or something, and he's got it covered, man. Like, if that tree twitches again, it is a goner, because this guy's going to take it out. But unfortunately... Don't think I won't kill you, tree. But unfortunately, unbeknownst to him, this tree was just running interference for this goblin who is, was just waiting to pounce on him. I'm not sure if this is actually connected to the... I mean, this does seem to be... I mean, I think these must be elves. I don't see who else they could be.
Could there be like a, you know, a space between the tree and the, whatever it is he's standing on, so he's actually aiming it at something below him?
Could this be the...
Is that an orc right over the...
Yeah.
It's possible. It's possible that this guy's not quite as clueless as he looks, but certainly,
could it be an outpost and an outlook?
That's actually my vote, because I don't think, for two reasons, I don't think Azog is going to be attacking the halls of the Elven King. For one, that's going to, if the hall of the Elven King is under assault by orcs, it's going to be a little awkward for him to actually take his army to the Lonely Mountain. Secondly, Azog was never going around with a huge... I mean, maybe he's call up reinforcements or, you know, they've created a bunch of Zomborks or I don't know. But it seems like this seems to me likelier to be Azog and his comparatively small band of orc hunters attacking an outpost as they're trying to find or whatever. I don't know exactly what Azog... Well, I know what his goal is, but... what his plan is, I'm not really quite sure, but I would expect this to be an outpost.
Well, and I think that fits. Doesn't Thranduil, in the big speech that he gave in the live stream that you guys had saw it, doesn't he complain to Thorin from his, you know, he's lounging up in his throne, and doesn't he complain to Thorin that you brought orcs to my doorstep, or he's mad because they've attracted orcs into his realm, kind of thing. Doesn't he say something like that?
I don't remember that.
Oh.
Makes sense, though. And it certainly would...
I know, it does.
It certainly would be a logical expansion on the Elven King's anger about them stirring up the spiders in the book. Right. Again, with that same idea of you have brought evil upon us.
How upset he'd be about Zomborks?
Well, I know, exactly. I mean, if the spiders bother him... Okay. Speaking of spiders. That spider looks awesome. The spiders in film one that were attacking Radagast's house looked pretty bad. This spider looks really quite awesome, I thought.
Yep.
And,
you know, and I think...
But man, this is another one of those scenes, though. It's put the ring
put
on.
The ring put the ring on. Ring, exactly. Ring on. Don't hide behind the tree. Get invisible, you doofus.
Does he
I wanted to say...
Does he look like he's scared and hiding, or does he look like he's stealing himself to attack?
Both.
Both. Well, you know, I wanted to say, isn't this a great example of what a great actor Martin Freeman is with his face? He doesn't need to say anything, but you just read exactly what's going on his face. Well,
true.
Yeah.
It looks like he's hiding and he's trying to decide what to do.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah, yeah. Kay thinks he just woke up. Yeah, it looks like he's possibly hungover. But no, I agree. I'm teasing now. But, yeah. Sharon says I can just hear a little Attercop Tom Noddy here.
he's getting ready to burst out.
Trying to remember the words.
I will give Peter Jackson a gold star if the word Tom Noddy is uttered by anyone at any point in this film. I'm not picky.
Yeah. What if it's uttered in verse?
Hey, I'd 3 gold stars if it is uttered
3
in verse.
3 gold stars.
Absolutely. Tony says I will throw money at the screen. Yeah, yeah, exactly. If there is an actual sung song that contains the word Attercop and Tom Noddy, even if they alter it, I will
the closing song.
Yeah. I would be perfectly happy. That actually looks accurate. This is the secret door opening. Size wise, my first response when I looked at them, like, wow, that looks really small. But actually, I think that's right.
Yeah.
It's a little short. 5 feet high, the door, and 3 may walk abreast.
3 feet wide.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, I mean, I think...
You can't count Bomber. I guess you'd have to count Bomber as 2.
Right, yeah, exactly. Maybe it's like 1.5 Bombers could walk abreast.
Beast.
Yes.
You will destroy us all.
Okay.
So Will Turner is against going, trying for the mountain.
Apparently. Yes, Will Turner making an impassioned...
Yes, but remember, Dave, trailers can be misleading.
That's true.
It's true.
Yeah, Trish and I were talking about this earlier because our latest digest, we discussed this.
Yeah,
and
we did.
I did say I was the only one who said he'd be openly against them. I just wanted to toot my own horn there. And Trish said, well...
But he still could change his mind, so we'll see. Yeah.
I think they've edited the trailer. I think what he was actually saying is you won't get us all killed.
and let me help you. What do you need?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is a good shot of the
But I think that would be great. So let me help you every way I can.
Yeah, Ben's right. We have to be careful. Right. Trailers can be misleading. This might not actually be Will
Turner. That's right.
Now, for the record, Sarah would like to point out that his nose looks totally different from Will Turner's nose. Yes. And I agree. But it's the facial hair, I think, that says Will Turner. And between that and the hairstyle, but really my question
is walking up to him and saying, "I can see Legos walking." I said, "Have we met somewhere before?"
Yeah, exactly. Like, though obviously he's missing an opportunity because he's not wearing one of these awesome hats.
Wearing the awesome helmet.
Those are great.
Those are fantastic.
Absolutely excellent helmet. They're clearly designed as a defensive weapon. You just form a tight phalanx and all lower your heads at the charging enemy. And that would be quite remarkable.
Do those look somehow like they're optimized to defend you against dragons? Not really. There's really no difference.
Really, yeah, it's hard to imagine.
They look very ceremonial.
Yeah,
they look very ceremonial, but not very functional.
Not very practical. Well, practical in the sense that they seem to be fur-lined, so that's practical.
They're warm.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, they're kind of like the Swiss Guard. You know, it's for show. You know, do you think that'll tie in with the Master of Lake Town? He's got a lot of stuff for show.
Probably.
He you know.
Probably.
I mean, Bard here looks like, you know, he means business. He could actually do something to defend the town, whereas these guys just look like, you know.
Yes,
they
that's
look
true.
In a parade, and that's about it.
Yeah,
these
yeah.
look like these look like the master's idea of a defense against the dragon.
Exactly.
Here, right. Hey, people, thinking, yep. people. Wear put this helmet on, you'll be safe.
Exactly.
By the way,
these helmets
it only cost 10. This is how he made his fortune. He was selling these on the infomercials.
Exactly. And we do
you
have this.
Saying, I don't need this. I don't need the stinking hat.
That's how you can tell he's a rebel.
One question that's really open in my mind here is to what extent we are to understand Bard to be speaking on behalf of the people. I mean, he's clearly... it's interesting, by the way, that Bard seems to be worried about the people. One of the questions we had when we were talking about Bard was he going to be a kind of a Robin Hood figure? Was he going to be a, you know, a loner, rebel kind of figure who's...
Zorro!
Yeah, who's sort of Zorro. Separated from his society. He seems to be... It's serving as at least a sort of an unofficial spokesperson for the people of Lake Town here.
That's true.
And not just thinking of himself.
Or just the voice of common sense.
Right.
You know, what's going on with the master of Lake Town is obviously not common sense.
Yeah. Tony does point out, of course, he is said to be always, speaking doom. You know, he is the grim-voiced man who is always prophesying floods and poison fish in the book. So the fact that he would have a kind of a, you know, downer view on things is certainly in keeping with his character in the book. Certainly you would not expect Bard from the book to be giving them an enthusiastic pep talk as they depart.
So that's a good question. So I guess the question is he speaking on the behalf of the people here, or did he barge into sort of a, is this sort of the part where the people are singing about how the rivers are going to be flowing with gold because the king under the mountain's back, and he crashed the party, and he's the guy that's he's raining on everyone's parades.
Right. Which is also what happens in the book. I mean, it's interesting because in the book, you know, in Lake Town, you've got like three factions. There's the master, there's Bard, and there's everybody else. And everybody else is just completely intoxicated by the idea, but you know, by the legends of the gold, and they're like going around singing more or less brainless songs. And I mean brainless because when they see the glow of the dragon fire, you know, they start saying, "Look, gold! The king is forging gold, and it's coming down the river to us." I mean, like, how stupid do you have to get to think that that's what's actually happening? So the people are pretty dumb. And they're only the two dissenting voices within Lake Town, not counting Bilbo. There are the two dissenting voices from that. One is Bard and one is the Master. But their perspectives are very different. The Master is cynical. Bard is not cynical. And of course, we see him responding, bravely, very obviously very differently from the Master when push comes to shove. But having him be... having everybody else, like maybe this guy who looks like a Monty Python extra in the background, maybe he's like one of the, maybe he was just like, you know, cutting a caper and celebrating, and then, you know, Mr. like doom and gloom realism
Buzzkill.
Comes in. And yeah, yeah, Captain Buzzkill comes in and says, yeah, that's not going to be.
Yeah, he's not known as Bard the moment until after he kills the dragon.
Yes, exactly. He's Bard the Buzzkill until then, yeah. Yeah. Alyssa says, maybe that's the symbolic function of the snow. It's not raining on their parade, it's snowing on their parade.
There you go.
Yeah, both Wesley and Philip have said at the same time, and I agree, it totally looks like, I was absolutely thinking of the guy who says that he's not dead yet in the Holy Grail. That's absolutely who that guy looks like to me. You're not fooling anyone, you know? I could easily see that. Though what the guards are doing in their pointy hats standing around is still unclear to me. Will be interesting to see how Stephen Fry figures into this equation here.
Oh yeah, Tony reminds us that Bilbo has a cold when he's in Lake Town. I wonder if he's going to have a cold.
Oh, yeah, I will be. He could make us happy so easily, right? I mean, Bilbo just has to like sniffle and sneeze once, and we'll be melting into little puddles of joy. So,
and and just give us a glimpse of a doll.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yana was pointing out that he says, I'm the only one. Am I the only one very disappointed about the complete lack of dolls in this trailer?
Absolutely not.
Yes.
I told him Sharon is also a voice disappointment. Yes.
Yeah. Well, but you know, it is just a 2-minute trailer, Yana. There's still hope. I'm not going to let go. It's possible. We can still hold out hope for that. Sharon points out that will Bilbo have a cold? Would be an excellent conundrum question. Okay.
Yes.
Well, now
I was going to tell Laura.
That. I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Now we come into the rapid shift of quick action scenes portion of the trailer. So we've got Gandalf and
being attacked by whoever that guy was
that we saw back in the trailer, the original trailer. Then we've got Legolas hitting somebody and Toriel not hitting somebody, and Bilbo, where is he?
I don't know.
Maybe he's jumped in to follow the barrels?
Yeah, that's
Brianna thinks
that's what it looks like.
Brianna said she thought it was after the barrels got released and then he jumps in.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a picture of Bilbo holding on to Keeley's barrel.
That's
at
later,
one point.
Yeah.
So maybe he's just holding on to barrels the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps so. Okay, the boot picture, I can't look at anything other than the toe of this dude's boot. And I don't understand the point of this shot in the trailer at all. What on earth is happening here? Why did we get the stomping of this one particular boot?
He's catching the key.
Is that the key?
Falling over the edge of the cliff.
The key?
And I think that's Thorin's foot.
It's falling over the edge of the cliff. Why is Thorin dropping the key over the edge of the cliff? Are we going to turn the opening of the door into an action sequence?
But I got to be honest with you.
It slipped out of his hand.
I'm having trouble worrying about the key now that I've seen this shot. What the heck is...
Okay.
Is that a rope?
That's another thing of the ride at Hobbitland.
There's a dwarf flying through the air.
Just when you thought it was improbable for the barrels to float upright down the river, now we have the barrels actually assuming the power of flight.
And who is that? That's not Bomber. No, that's not Bomber, because Bomber doesn't have an axe. And doesn't the orc look like he's on a line?
Yeah, he is.
It's not Azog, right?
It's an arrow.
No.
Somebody said it's an arrow. Oh. Not a line.
Yes, I think it is an arrow. But has the dwarf...
See, there's the key. See it?
Yeah, I did see it. Okay, there's the axe.
Oh, okay.
So...
Okay, yeah, that is an arrow.
That's an arrow, clearly.
That doesn't look like Bomber.
This is Bomber.
That looks like Bomber's braid.
And that's clearly an orc weapon, not his weapon.
Oh, okay. So I think that's Bomber.
Is
he grabbing the orc's weapon?
While they're flying... By?
Oh, it's an arrow. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
That's a better picture.
How did the orc even get there to be shot?
and what launched the barrel? I don't understand. I am being terribly inhibited by my understanding of physics.
It's like speed, Corey.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to move on. I can't make anything
just
of
an
this.
Action shot.
Okay.
I think we can rest assured.
Doesn't have to make
sense.
Okay.
This is confirmation that there will be elves, orcs, and barrel dwarves.
Involved. Right.
In
the
yes.
Escape.
Yeah. No. You're right. Thank you. Please let us cling to this one fact that we can take out of this, and that is that fact that we clearly have all three races interacting together. In this during the barrel episode. Now his barrel, which is being used, somehow has been launched from something into a party of goblins.
This is what,
and it doesn't look like they're in Mirkwood anymore, really, does
no
it?
This I is mean, the edges like this is land. Clearly like the show.
Yeah.
That's the, there's the lake right here.
Yep
so Tariel and Legolas must have dispatched all the orcs.
Well, they chucked the barrel containing Bomber at them. which, yes, assuming you can make that happen, has got to be.
We've moved beyond dwarf tossing and dwarf barreling to stuffing dwarves in barrels and then tossing them in the barrel.
It's like bowling. This is how bowling. Remember how golf got invented? This is how bowling got invented.
Yes, it's the invention of bowling.
Oh my goodness!
Wow. Okay. That's incredible. But now we have Legolas with his patented
point. Shooting an orc with an arrow from 2 feet away.
Yes. And this orc has the decency to stand still for long enough to let him do it, too. Okay, so we have this is definitely not just Legolas and Toriel on their own. We get several elves involved in this conflict. Look at this in the background here. Does not look like the outpost.
Yeah, it does.
That Azog was attacking.
It could be the door to the hall itself.
It's possible. Well, but
the land
it's
doesn't
not
fall off like that.
And it's not wooded enough. This is too open.
Yeah, that's true.
Plus, if this is anywhere in the vicinity of the dwarf launching, it's got to be closer to the shores of the lake than that.
By the way, you notice that Legolas doesn't have his armor on here, so I wonder if this is an earlier scene, like when they realize there's orcs around, then later he puts his armor on.
Oh, yeah, possibly.
This is actually in Holland. They just, they ran over the rest of the mountains. It took them 15 minutes, and they engaged in battle there.
In Holland, yeah.
Yes.
Nothing, I suppose, could be likelier. Okay, so, and then we have Toriel. Whatever else you might say about Toriel, her vertical leap is pretty impressive. I mean, that was pretty good.
Yep,
that's going to be great in 3D.
Yeah.
So is the hobo too.
Yeah, well, though he's jumping off of something. She's jumping downhill, truly, but still, I mean,
she got some air.
Yeah, Toriel, unlike that dude in the Spurs, Toriel could dunk over LeBron James. It's perfectly clear. Then we've got, okay. This is presumably the same dude with whom Gandalf is fighting in the other earlier scene.
I love this still. This still is perfect.
Yeah, this is excellent. My subtitle for this would be a failed suicide attempt. seriously, where was he? I mean, like, on that platform. Is this a diving platform up here?
Definitely the worst prison ever.
Yeah.
He's at Galdor, but he's not a prisoner.
We speculated as to why Thrian was even outside to begin with, right? Exactly. What do they give him, does he just have,
he just creeps
around
the place? I guess.
I love this. Wilfred has my favorite theory ever. It's one of the blue wizards.
Who are coming back to get back at Gandalf for not remembering their names.
And this is Dol Guldur, right? I mean, I would definitely say that it is, with the trees growing around the rock and that kind of thing.
It's definitely, I mean, it's got to be Mirkwood, right? I mean, because of that. So that is, we're not off in wherever, at whatever improbable distance they are to discover the Tomb of the Nazgul. So, yeah, this has got to be.
Okay. Well, Pete says, like Hurin, Sauron was finished with Thrian, he let him go. I want to remind you that I believe Corey did guess that, right? Wasn't that your thing with Thrian, that he's actually living in Mirkwood?
I am standing by that prediction. Believe. Yes, Thrian is crazy hermit who's been living on his own and free in the wilderness ever since the Battle of Hazan Ulbazar. Absolutely. So this is him, because he also has decided to stage a crazy solo attack on Dol Guldur at the same time and is fighting Gandalf off. That's totally, absolutely. Now, by the way, this is not Orcrist.
Oh, okay. That's exactly what I was going to ask you.
I think this is just like a bomber in midair in barrel was clearly wielding had his hand on a goblin axe. They've clearly been seizing these weapons because remember they've just escaped from the elves, so they don't have any weapons. So
so Keely took a bow and an arrow from an elf, I guess.
No, this is a goblin bow.
He's also having the time of his life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's clearly only one person who's enjoying this trip. And there's no question about which one. And there's Bilbo clinging on to Kiwi's barrel.
And Ori has lost his star hairdo, it looks like.
No, this is the Ori. It's Nori with the star hairdo.
Oh, Nori with our, okay, star
I hairdo. Think this is, that looks like Ori, though the nose is a little odd. I mean, even odd by the standards of the dwarves in this film. So that's not Orcrus. So it looks like, but this is still Thorin, but it's not Orcrus that he's wielding.
Was that an earthquake?
That, my lad, was a dragon.
Dramatic pause.
Yeah. Balin knows how to deliver a line, doesn't he?
Yeah. Boy. Balin is. I love Balin. I am. You know, and I had said. I remember being asked this question. You know, which character in the book do I most hope they do a good job with? And I said Balin. And I got to say, I'm pleased. I like Balin in the film a lot. I think they did. I think they did very well. Okay.
Alright.
And now the last scene. Now, the question is, how do you recover from this?
I know.
Like, okay, just we put ourselves into Bilbo's position here. What are your options exactly at this point?
Put on the ring.
Well, that being the option which apparently he's decided to forego.
And at this point, it's too late.
Yeah.
He knows the general vicinity of you.
Yes. But, you know, I mean, this addresses, as does that shot of him hiding behind the tree as the spider climbs up the other side, addresses one of the questions that we've had from the beginning. Indeed, one of the things that I mentioned, like, way back in 2007, when this movie was only a very distant rumor in my very first Hobbit lecture ever, when I recorded it originally, which is, how are you going to do all of these long sequences in the book when he's wearing the ring? The answer seems to be he's clearly going to wear the ring much less of the time. Now, is this the conversation? Are we going to actually have him talking face to face with Smaug and then escape?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
You know, Ben says it's a visual way to emphasize how weak dragons are to flattery. That is, if Bilbo is actually able to distract him enough through their conversation, it certainly would play up that element to it. And presumably this is prior to the mad slide down the pile of treasure that we get, you know, earlier, that we got earlier in the trailer. But it's just this does seem to kind of strain belief.
Several people have theorized that maybe they haven't added the special effect yet, but the only special effect this could be is we don't see Bilbo.
Yeah.
Because the cameras were outside of Bilbo, so.
And it looks
like a really expensive way to film this scene. Let's film
it looks
in
like
the
dragons. It looks like the dragon's looking at Bilbo too, because he kind of squints his eye at him a little
bit. Yeah, and you've got the light actually radiating from his eye, and you can see that light, the spotlight of his eye, which, by the way, I take as a reference to the Rankin-Bass film.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen Peter Jackson make deliberate allusions to the Rankin-Bass film and to the Bakshi films. In both the Lord of the Rings film and in the Hobbit film. And I actually do take the beam of light projected from Smaug's eye here, which doesn't look a hundredth as dorky as it does in the Rankin Bass version, but I do take that as a reference. But you know, I don't buy it. I do not at all buy the fact that that the actual scene in the film is going to look nothing like this. I don't think with the positioning of this shot, you know, maybe you could convince me of that with one of those small little shots that we got for half a second through the middle of it. But this culminating scene that we linger on for this long, and which is obviously one of the scenes that Jackson's got to know, that, you know, if there's one scene in the second film that everybody's looking forward to, it's got to be the conversation with Smaug, right? I mean, clearly that's got to be number one on millions of people's lists. I cannot imagine that he would give us this scene in the trailer, would build up to this scene in the trailer the way that he does, and then have it look nothing like this in the film. I just can't believe that that would happen.
Yeah.
And Hans, I agree. Hans is also pointing out that it's also that the beam of light is also reminiscent, of course, of the Eye of Mordor in The Return of the King. Yes, I agree. No, there's the parallel there, which of course was already suggested by that final final sight in film one, being the opening of his eye looking rather Smaug-like. Looking rather Sauron-like at the very end of the first film. Yep. So.
Oh my God, we got to the end. Look, we're not even that bad. It's only 2 hours and 20
minutes. 2 hours and 20. See, we really picked up the pace there. I wasn't worried. Anything else to say about this last scene?
Our post Comic Con last year was over 3 hours, so hey, you know.
Exactly.
I will say one last thing here is I'm trying to figure out sort of the chronology of his visit to Smaug. So, you know, we've seen him on the Mountain of Gold, which I assume is while before Smaug, like, either wakes up or, you know, like, Smaug's not looking for him at that point. And then I'm trying to figure out if this is during the same visit, because we've talked before about how many visits might there be.
Yes.
Would this be during the same visit, or does he come back? So, I mean, I realize we can't answer those questions yet, but I was trying to connect this to the scene before where he's sliding down the gold.
Yeah, I mean, I would, because you're right, it's possible that the sliding down the gold, well, no, it couldn't be the sliding down, I mean, it could not be that the sliding down the gold scene is on a previous visit, because of course, just to refresh people's memories, in the book, he goes down once and steals the cup while Smaug is asleep and having his dream. He goes down the second time, and Smaug is pretending to be asleep, but is alert, and Bilbo realizes this and stays in the doorway, never ventures close to the treasure, and they have their conversation from there, and then Bilbo, of course, departs in a hurry with the flames licking around his back and his heels. The third time he goes down is after Smaug has departed. So when they're hiding in the mouth of the tunnel with the tunnel collapsed behind them, and they descend and go down after hanging out in the tunnel for a long time. So the third time he goes down and Smaug is already dead, though he doesn't know it yet.
I wonder, that's the chronology in the book. The first two visits, you know,
yeah.
He comes down, Smaug, he thinks Smaug is asleep. And so he comes down without his ring on, and then Smaug wakes up and kind of catches him. They have a conversation, and then Bilbo runs out of there and slides down the gold.
I think they'll cut out the stealing of the cup.
I think that's very likely.
I think the way that they've evolved his story arc, I think the burglar thing is not that important. You know what I mean? Like throughout the book, he's constantly trying to prove himself as a burglar. I feel like that's just not that important in this.
But he will take the Arkenstone at some point.
Yeah, I wonder take the Arkenstone sooner rather than later, because it's after Smaug is dead in the book he takes the Arkenstone.
Yes.
They'll have him find the Arkenstone much earlier.
It's possible, though. It's hard because, I mean, with the very, very great, you know, very significant extra weight that they seem to be giving to the Arkenstone, it would invest that theft with so much more significance. I still believe it's going to happen, Bilbo's theft of the Arkenstone, but I would think it would be kind of anticlimax if they really are going to build up the Arkenstone as the thing which in some sense confers lordship upon Thorin. To have the dragon still be alive and Bilbo be, you know, and to have be, hey, look, I have secured the kingship of the mountain already, though Smaug is still alive, would seem a little bit strange.
Well, I don't think he would show, I think he would hide it.
Right.
I don't think he
right.
would show them. He'd take it and...
Right, but even just
does,
to have it
does Bilbo,
himself.
Does Bilbo even know what the Arkenstone is? At this point,
he hasn't been told about it on screen, but he still might. But he still might not be. Yana says the cup, the golden cup, will probably be replaced by the doll from Dale. That's what he'll steal on the first visit.
One can only hope.
Yeah. 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 But no, I agree about the, I agree about the general comment, Dave, that you made about burglary, and its comparative de-emphasis in the film, which of course goes along with the fact that the book emphasizes the burglary more because it's about the gold. And that was the whole point of hiring a burglar, was to go in and steal gold. That's his job. That's what a burglar does. So when you de-emphasize the gold, de-emphasizing the burgling also seems quite logical. And I agree, it's not been a major part of his character arc, though it was emphasized enough. Because remember, it is emphasized both not only at the beginning with the contract and everything, but also later on at the troll scene, where, of course, in the book, his, you know, burglarious activities are heavily emphasized. But even in the film, remember there's that, you know, Feely and Keely are talking about, you know, having the burglar go to investigate the trolls, when they see them. So it does get referred to again. We don't totally forget about it and leave it behind, but I think, isn't that the last reference to burglary of any kind in the first film?
I
certainly do agree that it is strongly de-emphasized in the film. So I agree, for that reason, it would make perfect sense to exclude the golden cup. Nothing could be more plausible than to contract the two visits down to the Horde. So one thought
about the Bilbo's appearance thing. On the one hand, I'm very persuaded by Ben's point that the scene might actually be, that I could see the scene maybe even working better if Smaug can see him.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't kill him. Or maybe you try it right at the end, Bilbo figures out how to escape or something. I guess, truth be told, even when he was invisible, it probably wouldn't have been that hard for Smaug to kill him.
Well, it wasn't, because his sense of smell is excellent, and his sense of hearing is very acute. So he's already beginning to pinpoint where Bilbo is, and that's why when Bilbo runs away at the end of the conversation in the book, Smaug knows where he's going and, you know, puts his mouth to the hole and breathes fire up the tunnel. He can tell where Bilbo is. And also, you know, when you think about it, it's not like Smaug is going to be threatened, right? He's got Bilbo trapped here. Mm-hmm. One could easily imagine Smaug, especially with the personality he has in the book, deciding to toy with the thief first and have a conversation with him. And then have Bilbo put on the ring as a surprise.
Especially because he wants to determine where Bilbo came from and
right.
what his motives are in being there. So
right, exactly. So I do think, but yes, Sharon, I was thinking the same thing. Sharon says it's important that Smaug does not know what a hobbit is and might be curious. Remember, there's that all that emphasis in The Hobbit, and much more emphasis in The Quest of Erebor, about how hobbit smell is going to be foreign to Smaug, and he's going to be confused and curious if he smells a hobbit, because he won't have any idea what it is. And so you can certainly you can certainly see that being expanded. Smaug's reaction to seeing this guy standing on his treasure would not necessarily be, I must kill you instantly, but rather simply, who are you? What are you? What are you doing? What do you think you're doing? You know, what's happening here? Let me figure out this stuff, figure out whom you're in league with, and also have some fun by, you know, torturing you. So, you know, that's seems to me very plausible that they could have this conversation face to face. He's just got to be able to escape. And presumably the ring features in there, though, again, he's not invisible as he's sliding down the gold earlier in the trailer.
I got to tell you, I think this scene between Smaug and Bilbo is just going to be awesome. It's going to be as awesome as the Riddles in the Dark in the first movie.
I hope so.
Or maybe even more awesome.
I hope so. Well, I mean, they did do such a good job with the Riddles in the Dark exchange. I mean, you know, Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis did such a great job. I really am hoping for good things from Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch here.
So, Corey, can you comment on Smaug's appearance and apparent size? He seems really huge.
Size is large. That's larger than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Though not larger than... I mean, if you think of him coming through the gates of Erebor and squashing dwarves underfoot in film one, it's consistent with that. The scale is.
I'm thinking more book, like...
Yeah.
It's hard to... I mean, a creature like this being slain by an arrow.
It's a special arrow. and it does... I mean, in the book, it does describe the arrow as going into his chest, you know, barb, shaft, and feather. So it's not like, you know, we're supposed to imagine a small dragon with an arrow, you know, sticking all the way through him and out the other side or something like that. I mean, it's the arrow disappears inside the large body of the dragon. So
it doesn't have to be big if it hits the right spot, right?
Right, exactly. And if it disappears all the way inside, then yeah.
I thought Smaug would be a little, I don't know, better looking, I guess. Not so... I can't really describe it, but he's not very sleek.
Yeah, I agree.
He looks very prehistoric.
He is a little, he is kind of...
Yeah, almost like a dinosaur.
Yeah, he does not look like the T-Rex thing, the fake T-Rex thing from the behind-the-scenes footage. But,
that's right.
But he looks reminiscent of that a little bit. He's got a huge head.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping more like the dragon in Merlin.
I kind of like him, though.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, clearly Peter Jackson is being coy by releasing this scene again, because although we finally see the head of Smaug, we're still seeing it in shadow except for his eye. So it's a little hard to tell from the lighting in this scene what he would look like in full light. I agree, Laura, the impression that... this shot that I've frozen it at right here makes him look like some kind of deep-sea fish. You know, like, probably that, like, scuttles around the bottom of a coral reef. And that look doesn't really do it for me. I agree. Something more sleek and sort of svelte looking. Because he's vain, right? And, like, anybody as ugly as that, like, being vain is just absurd. I would have actually expected him to be more beautiful. But
yeah, that's kind of what I thought too.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's scarier. He's scarier this way.
He's not the golden because he has all of those gems on his belly, right?
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how they do that. Actually,
yeah.
Because the gems for a dragon this size, those gems would have to be freaking huge to be wedged in among his scale.
That are a lot of gems.
That are very, very numerous, yes.
Yeah.
And Sam said he did look sleeker in the previous close-up. I agree. It is partially that sight of, you know, the bit of him that emerged around his eye at the end of the first film. which led me to expect something less bumpy than this dragon.
But, less barnacles.
Yes.
You know, thanks a lot, Corey. Now I look at him, all I can see is a deep sea fish.
Yeah.
a little angler thing on his
exactly,
head.
Yeah. You just put a little thing off his nose here with a little glowy bit at the end.
Smaug the bumpy.
Smaug the bumpy angler fish. That's exactly it. Yeah. So we'll see.
Still looks pretty cool, though.
We'll see. Yeah, I mean, I'm still... But again, I said it's also clear, as I say, that Jackson is still being coy, and this is like the reveal that is not yet the full reveal of what the dragon looks
right,
like. So
right. It's true. Yeah. They can still tinker with him. Also, honestly, I'm not that obsessed about what he looks like.
Yeah, I think that his voice and personality is going to matter much more to me.
Yeah.
And as long as he doesn't sound... as long as he doesn't sound like a backwoods version of Johnny Cash, like the voice of Smaug does in the Rankin-Bass film, of all the annoying things in the Rankin-Bass film, the voice of Smaug is, to me, one of the most annoying. I mean, I can...
Our gun will travel.
Is that worse than the Elven King?
Yes, worse than the Elven King with his mysterious German accent. Worse than... you know, who looks like a frog and sounds German. Worse even than Smaug's...
Worse than his fur?
Yeah, even worse than Smaug's, like, fuzzy kitten face and whiskers that he has for some completely unknown reason.
Eyes.
Worse than that is him speaking... it's so annoying. The way that he sounds like a hick, like an American hick. It's just, that is not at all. Anyway.
Richard Boone, huh?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Like, my apologies to Richard Boone, but, like, he should not have been cast as the voice of Smaug. I am sorry.
Yeah,
but.
That's a little weird.
Anyway. That is... I agree. More important to me than his appearance is his voice and personality. And I certainly hope that we will get, you know, an urbane and sophisticated and cunning dragon from Smaug. So
yeah.
And that's it, right?
Also, did that make you guys more
December
or less 13th? Excited?
I really liked it. I thought it was a really good trailer. The visuals are really nice. You know, there's a lot of cool action scenes. I thought it was, and visually, I think it looks. Trish said this too. It looks a little better than the first movie.
I
couldn't grab it. I was just telling her.
Oh god, she took the smog picture and then drew an anglerfish thing on it.
Oh, did
she? Yeah, she gave us a URL here. Let me put.
All right,
it
hang on. I'll see if I can get it here. Hang on.
Okay. Anyway, you were saying, Laura. Sorry.
Well, I liked what they did with Tariel too. Her character is interesting. She's intriguing. She's not just a romantic interest for somebody, which would have been awful. I liked Thranduil, whose name I can't pronounce. I liked his character more so than just in the still pictures I'd seen. Oh, very nice. That's really nice.
Yeah.
Yes. Excellent. Though the little lure should be over, like tempting Bilbo over. You know, it should be a little more over.
Kind of like in Finding Nemo.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should have bubbles coming from his mouth. Bilbo's mouth.
So my assessment from the trailer is the two biggest or the two most obvious kind of places where they seem to be doing something very different is Dol Guldur, where we have no idea what they're doing. And then the barrel scene is like a complete change from the book. How do you guys feel about those, especially the barrel scene?
Well, the barrel scene, at least the barrel scene is in there.
That's right.
So I don't know how they could have done it like it was in the book. But the Dol Guldur, I mean, yeah, that is, I'm not really clear on what's going on. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's much of a battle if it's just Gandalf and Radagast there.
Well, you know, I agree. That's one thing that, and we'll see, maybe we'll get, you know, cause we'll get other trailers and we'll see what they reveal. But judging on this trailer alone, there was not much Dol Guldur in this. I mean, a very small percentage of this trailer was
maybe
Dol Guldur.
Maybe the battle's in the next movie.
Well, that was...
No!
That, I know. And then...
But don't forget, we also haven't seen Stephen Fry yet, so the Battle of Dol Guldur could still be in this movie. They just haven't done a trailer for it.
Yes.
Or...
Well, it seems like...
The other possibility is maybe there's no battle.
Maybe they cut the battle.
Well,
Gandalf's going to sneak in. They're going to catch Sauron. He's going to run away.
Well, if Bilbo's already having his conversation with the dragon, and the next thing you know, the dragon is flying away and it has got to be killed very quickly. I'm sorry, that's a spoiler. In the third movie,
they killed the dragon.
Wait, the dragon dies?
There's not that much left for them to do in the third movie, unless they're going to make up a whole bunch of stuff, except to have, like, the Battle of Dol Guldur.
Well, no.
They could make up stuff.
I've been maintaining all along that I think they're going to Harry Potter it, and the third film is going to be at least half Battle of Dol Guldur.
Yeah, I expect
Battle of Five Armies,
yeah.
At the latest,
they'll kill the dragon right at the start of it. Like, I don't think he's going to last very long past this.
No.
Film. This is his film.
No.
And what's more, the standoff at the Lonely Mountain is something that could be significantly expanded. You know, the attempts at negotiation, and when I say expanded, I don't mean even added to. It's just like if we get, you know, discussions among, like, if we're going to get internal politics among the elves, you know, like if we're going to get, you know, three ways between Thranduil and Toriel and Legolas about what they should or shouldn't do, and Toriel objecting, like, we should be helping them, not fighting against them or whatever. And then, you know, Bard and the Master and their relationship with the elves and what's going on there. And then their negotiations with Thorin. And meanwhile, in the Lonely Mountain, Thorin is going increasingly crazy. And then Bilbo's going to sneak out and he's going to have, I mean, that stuff could take quite a bit of film time. If they actually show us those things. So we've got like the political stuff leading up to the abortive Battle of Three Armies that almost happens between the dwarves and the elves and the humans. And then we get into the actual Battle of Five Armies proper. So, you know, especially if we add to that any kind of backstory on where the goblins come from, and we don't just have them pop up out of nowhere the way they do in the book. So I do think that the post-Death of Smaug segment of the story certainly is enough for a film. I mean, that could certainly work. But I could also see the Battle of Dol Guldur happening at the start of film three. You know, we'll see. But that was definitely a question in my mind after watching this trailer. Though, as I say, we'll see what other trailers show. As I confessed before, yeah. I liked Toriel in this trailer a heck of a lot more than I expected to. I am interested to see exactly where they go with that. I was glad that they, because I was kind of worried, you know, and when we talked about Legolas in the context of discussing Thranduil and the Elven King's politics a couple episodes ago, you know, having Legolas be the person who is sort of standing up to his father, and I was then and still continue to be assuming that Thranduil is going to be largely a jerk through most of this. And the question is, who's going to be the voice of non-jerkitude, who's going to be contrary to Thranduil, assuming that there is such a voice. And we had been speculating maybe that's Legolas. And if it's Toriel instead of Legolas, I actually like that better. If they actually go against the whole, like, massive, you know, fan base for Legolas and everybody, like, Legolas being the hero of everybody who was under the age of 15 when they saw the Lord of the Rings films. You know, I mean, if they actually go counter to that whole wave and have Legolas be kind of a, like a genuine jerk in this film, that would be, I think, really bold and really cool. So, you know, so I'm interested in that whole, in that whole plot. I'm interested in seeing how Toriel and Legolas, you know, fit and how they go with Thranduil.
I think Toriel, you know, she seems to have Legolas's ear, if nothing else. And so perhaps she convinces him.
Right.
Yeah. The other thing, we didn't see Bolg, or were we not supposed to see Bolg in this film?
Well, that's another, I was going to say that too. That's another character we haven't seen. And he, even more so than Stephen Fry. I mean, we don't even know if he's actually going to be in the movie now, right? Except for the fact that they've already made Bolg dolls. So I figure he must be in the movie someplace.
Just think of what a collector's item those Bolg dolls will be someday if he gets completely cut from the films. I have the action figure of the non-character. That would be awesome.
Right, that's right. It's like that Beatles album that they didn't end up using that became a huge collector's item.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, do you think the elves will kill Azog?
Boy, that would be anticlimactic.
Yeah, it would be. It would be.
Except that I would think that they still want to go with the Bolg avenging his father's death thing, especially, you know, at the Battle of Five Armies.
Especially if they don't kill him personally, he just gets picked off by a stray arrow.
Yeah.
Or a dwarf barrel.
A dwarf barrel, exactly. I was thinking, he like, you know, he...
Crushed by bomber.
Right. Maybe he's just gonna suffer some kind of debilitating concussion after being hit by a barrel full of bomber. And, you know, will not actually be killed, but, you know, will be sidelined.
Bolg shows up at the Battle of Five Armies looking for the fat dwarf.
Yeah. We'll have to go through neurological screening first, and the doctors will have to clear him to participate in the Battle of Five Armies, and it's going to be complicated.
The other thing about the third movie, too, is we have Dian to be introduced.
Yes.
And, I mean, he can't just show up out of nowhere. I mean, there's got to be some backstory there, right?
Yeah. And again, there's another plot line in the lead-up to the Battle of Five Armies, you know, where you've got Dian being introduced and Roach the Raven and him talking to both of them, right. And... You know, we there are a number of scenes which could very easily be done leading up to the conflict, you know, the handing over of the Arkenstone and the Descendant of Rats scene and all of that stuff. Oh, so yeah. There's
but
definitely a lot of material
there.
Do a
fourth movie.
Yeah, exactly. A fourth movie. You just can't possibly squeeze this whole book into three films. It's just, there's too much. Yeah, but no, I mean, I literally, you know, though I'm joking about it, I literally cannot imagine Azog not being present at the Battle of Five. I mean, unless we do get a vengeance thing, but honestly, I think it's too late for that. I would have expected Thorin to kill Azog at the end of film one. Had Azog died at the end of film one, I would have been all ready for, you know, for Bolg to come in and like, you killed my father after you already dismembered my father. Adding further insult to injury. Yeah, exactly. yeah, you dismembered and subsequently killed my father. Prepare to die. But it's we're off of that plot now. I mean, even if they come in and manage to ambush them in the barrels, it's an anticlimactic moment for Azog to die. That was too much of a build-up in film one for him to be like to survive the whole arc of film one and then to be killed in a skirmish in a random action sequence in the middle of film two. That can't happen. I don't believe it.
I especially love the idea of him just sort of getting just running along and then getting hit in the head with an arrow and just.
Yeah,
that'd be way too Game of Thrones.
After all,
exactly.
I'm wondering, The other thing I'm wondering is after this chasing with the barrels, where do the orcs go? I mean, that's the other one for me. I mean, obviously, Azog's not going to die. So, you know, where are they going to go? And is he going to regroup and not show up again until the Battle of Five Armies?
Maybe this is the context for Legolas's comments about this isn't our fight. They're chasing the dwarves. The orcs attack. The elves end up fighting the orcs. And the conclusion is the elves manage to fight off the orcs and buy time for the dwarves to escape. And Legolas is like, what are we doing, guys? We just helped the dwarves escape. This isn't our battle. Why are we doing this?
We came out here to capture the dwarves, and here we were, minding our own business, shooting arrows at dwarves in barrels, which seemed like good fun, and now all of a sudden we're involved in an all-out battle against orcs. What are we doing? Where did we lose our way?
That's right. Yeah. When did we get away from what really makes us us?
Cause.
Yes. We're elves, guys. We're not supposed to be killing orcs. We're supposed to be shooting at dwarves in barrels.
We've got to keep our eye on the long-term goal here. Oh, yeah.
Besides which, what are we going to tell my dad when we go back now? The dwarves got away and the orcs got away too? Oh, my God.
Yeah. We set out to recapture them. I don't know how we ended up helping them escape, but before we knew it... You know, we were aiding and abetting, and I can't even remember when it started happening. I just really... The whole thing...
And then on his next mission...
Settle up my elk.
Yeah.
On his next mission, Legolas is going to be like, when I return, think better of the father.
Yes, exactly.
That depends on the manner of which you return. Don't come back with any more stories about it.
Yeah.
By the way, we let everyone get away.
Yeah.
I know, Sharon. We are getting punchy. This happens.
It does. Okay.
I've actually had to mute myself a couple times. I've been laughing so hard I was crying.
we're approaching the 3-hour mark here. But no, I think this has all been very good. But no, I will say, compared to the trailers from the first film, this trailer did have more "wait, what the heck is going on" moments for me. Like, I had more moments of pure confusion in watching this trailer than I did in watching any of the other trailers.
That's true.
Like the Bjorn's.
And it's not just because of the crazy editing.
Right. Exactly.
Shot of Dol Guldur. There's a shot of the forest. There's a shot of the river. There's a shot of Lake Town. Back to Dol Guldur. No, the forest again. Nope. Back to Lake Town.
Right. Right. No, it wasn't just that. Even taking them all apart and taking them separately, there are many of them that still require much analysis for me to become even modestly unconfused. And about some of them, such as what implement is used to hurl a barrel-containing bomber, I still don't understand. I mean, I think you could build a very large trebuchet that could accomplish this.
Trebuchet,
but it's a little hard for me to imagine either that the elves happen to have a trebuchet mounted at this particular place
it's
in the river.
It's another Monty Python moment.
Right, exactly. Perhaps if we built a large wooden badger...
There was one being stored in the warehouse with the barrels. The dwarves took it. That was actually what Bilbo rode down the river.
Was on
the dwarves are all in. The dwarves are all in barrels. Bilbo was riding a trebuchet.
Riding a trebuchet, which they then assembled swiftly, so as
he threw it in at the last moment, just in case they'd need it. Right.
Yeah.
It was by the entrance and by the exit there into the river. Oh, I'm going to throw this in.
By the way, one thing about the barrels that we didn't cover, it seems fairly obvious that their escape is not going to be one of Bilbo tricking the elves into just releasing them.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and actually, it reminds me of something I was going to say earlier on.
Unless the elves are really, really drunk.
Right. Exactly.
Whoa, man, what is in this wine? I think I see people in those barrels.
Right, take them in the river. Exactly. Should the wine barrels have very, very strange, like, heads with very strange hairdos sticking out of them? I don't think that's normal. But no, the other thing I was going to say is, you know, as wacky as this barrel ride looks, and as much as, you know, people are going to be complaining that that's not in the book, the thing that I think you just, if you have any interest at all in being fair to a film adaptation, you have to recognize the fact that there are lots of things that happen in the books, which if they were faithfully represented on the films, would be really boring. And the barrel ride is one of them.
The barrel ride will be boring?
If the barrel ride were depicted exactly as it is in the books, it would be really dull.
No, I think that'll make great film.
What, like a bunch of barrels, some slightly lower in the water than the others, bobbing along until they're bound into a raft, and then a dude sitting, trying not to sneeze for several hours while he's being pulled gently down the river on a raft, and overhearing their conversation about local politics and the relations, the trade relations between the elves and the men.
You're rising to his bait.
I also want to hear the pole elves singing.
Now, that would, of course, be a way to liven up that scene. But
I don't mind that they have changed the barrel riding scene. So, because that would be a very long, slow point.
Yeah, it would be very slow.
My only complaint.
Yeah.
This is the same complaint we've made since the beginning
your
of this.
Your only
this
complaint, story. Dave?
Yeah. Your only about the changes
I just
to the barrel.
Want
to
clarify that.
No, about the barrel scene. I don't have a huge problem with the barrel. I don't even mind flying barrels. I think that's whatever. My main complaint about this is the same complaint that we've had since the very beginning of this podcast, which is, I agree, you couldn't do the barrel scene the way it was. The alternative would be to depict it in the way it's in the book, and then just don't show them floating down the river. Just show them leaving, a couple shots, show them arriving. That takes 30 seconds.
Right.
This scene looks like this is going to be a good 10, 15, 20 minutes of this. Easily. 10, 15, 20 minutes that could have been dedicated to, I don't know, Battle of Goldor.
Yeah.
How are they going to fit all this
but
crap
just think,
in?
Just think what a cool ride they're going to make out of it.
I agree, but...
Well,
but
it's
but
like...
There's
it's
always
like
a trade-off.
It's like the Rock'em Sock'em Robots. The kids are going to love it. My son is going to love it.
No, that's probably true. But you just wonder, what are we going to
look? That is the best. That's his favorite part in the first movie. Is
really the Stone Giants?
Oh,
really,
yeah, the Stone Giants.
Man, he must be really bummed that Guillermo del Toro didn't make the whole movie.
Well, and you know, in Star Wars, his favorite character is Jar Jar Binks. So
we can't trust the kids' judgment.
So there's his taste right there.
Well, no, you know, it's actually kind of refreshing to know that there actually does exist a target audience that are pleased by these things. You know, so that's
that's right.
It's a nod to the kids.
It's not just
the 8-year-old boys out there.
Yeah, that's true. It is nice to know that there is some rationale.
Well,
it's not utter insanity.
The whole barrel thing, I never understood how Bilbo could actually balance on the top of a barrel. I mean, he would immediately just go under.
With difficulty, with difficulty.
It's round. It's going to spin around. And it's going to go under. So
the one that he's on is occupied.
A little...
There's a dwarf weighting it down in the bottom. So that keeps it from rolling all the way over?
I didn't think it was. I thought it just shipped. He says it just took on a little water.
Yeah.
The water is going to move. And yeah, so you should do a little physics of barrel riding thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Hey, that would be an awesome myth mood event.
It's unrealistic, but you know, it's better than the wargs in the Two Towers.
Yeah, and Aragorn floating down the river. Yikes.
Aragorn, better than that.
I personally, I cannot wait for the behind-the-scenes material for this movie with the barrel stuff. One of my favorite things from the Fellowship of the Ring extra stuff is them talking about filming the scene where they're floating down the river in the boats from Lothlorien, and everyone complaining about how Sean Bean was using his paddle to push the other boats off course, and they would get yelled at by the director, like, where are you guys? Stop that. Where are you going? And they're like, it's Sean. It's not us. It's Sean Bean. He's doing it. I cannot wait to hear what kind of crazy hijinks they got up
that
to.
That does not look like it was fun to film at all.
No.
Maybe the barrels.
Also, you know, speaking a bit of the barrels, there was also a clip out of what Brianna put together that there's fish. Which maybe when they get into Lake Town, I mean, that might be how they you know, maybe Bart smuggles them in and he puts fish on top of the barrels. But I do remember that there was a scene where there were fish either, I think, on the barrel or in the barrel or something like that. So that's another mystery.
All right. David Urbach has also asked a really pressing question. Will there be a butler?
Yes. Well, again, you know, like, it's one of those things. It's like a piece of low hanging fruit for Peter Jackson. Like, all he has to, like, again, if he wants to just throw us a bone, all he has to do is have some minor character be named Galleon, right? I mean, we got Lindir, you'll remember, in Rivendell. So, like, if we get somebody named Galleon, who's the only elf given a proper name in The Hobbit. And people forget about this, but of course Thranduil is never called Thranduil. He's always just called the Elven King. Galleon the Butler is literally the only elf that has a name in the book. So, I Philip asks if the butler is the pointing elf. I hope he gets a better role than that. you know, he's just like, "Hi, I am the superfluous tour guide, and over here you have the only path that you can possibly see in this vista."
Somehow, I can't picture the elves with the butler.
Yeah, well, you know, no, I mean, you know, somebody's got to do the buttling, but
I
can see this, you know, but it does look like they're going to avoid the elven drunkenness dilemma completely. I mean, and this, of course, is something we've been talking about, how they painted themselves in a corner by having Legolas totally impervious to the effects of alcohol in the deleted scene from The Two Towers. Or, you know, I guess it was The Return of the King, wasn't it? At the beginning of it? Was it The Two Towers? I forget which one it was.
Yeah, it's somewhere.
But anyway, they're in Rohan. So anyway, so clearly they seem to be avoiding that. If they're just escaping when they're not looking, nobody has to be drunk, except perhaps the dwarves themselves, for that escape to actually happen. But okay, we should probably let people go. Good morning, Yana. Welcome. It's time to start your day. It's now 5 a.m. Over there in Europe. So I hope that it's anyway over here on the East Coast. I think it's time for us to go to bed. So thanks to everybody for joining us for our really long but unusually fun and lively episode discussing the trailer. This was a lot of fun. We're gonna still do our regular episode next week as we scheduled. This episode is pure bonus, just to talk about the trailer.
17th we're gonna do. I think it's 17th.
Yeah, Monday the 17th we're planning to do.
We'll put the dates up, but yeah, and that's gonna be a review. So it also will not be a numbered edition. It'll be a review of year to date Riddles and Conundrum.
Yeah, which is, yeah. So, but anyway, so we will be doing an episode next, yes, Monday, Sharon. Not Tuesday. We'll probably be shifting away from Tuesdays, actually. during the school year, Tuesdays were a lot easier for me, but now in the summertime, actually, Mondays and Wednesdays work a good deal better for me than Tuesdays. But anyway, Philip, yes, I do hope to post this as a video podcast. We're gonna try to do that. We've made a video recording of it, so that we can see, because it's gonna be a lot less interesting to hear us talk about the visual details for 3 hours if people can't see what we're talking about. But anyway, Yana, we're probably going to be doing a morning one again. Didn't we say? Did we agree on a time? Did we say morning on Monday? The 10 a.m.?
Yeah, it'll be 10 a.m. Yeah.
Yeah.
10 a.m. Monday.
Yeah, I think so. Yep. Yeah, not 10 p.m., Yana. No worries. We'll be back to a humane time that is humane to Europeans' time. Inhumane to poor Dime out in Alaska, sadly. but you know, we're kind of going to be keeping somebody awake at... somewhere in the world, wherever we post it. So
it's not Riddles in the Dark if someone's not suffering.
Exactly. Because that would be a really depressing motto. But anyway, yes, that seems to be how it works out. Okay. Oh, and Wilfred is in Alaska too. See, look, we have two Alaskans with us. So that's we have a genuine Alaskan block, therefore, among our attenders. So there we are. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. I will sign off now. So thanks to you guys, my panelists, for our fun discussion here tonight. I enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, it was really fun. We'll have to do this again we'll do this again when the next trailer comes out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. We'll definitely be thinking about that and of course the subsequent trailers never come out with quite so much fanfare as the first one does, but
that's true.
But I think this is definitely something we could do again. So anyway, thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.